But yeah, it's like if I got something that you think you can use and could be.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of ProJock. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rate. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship your reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.
Summer stuff that you'd expect for Morelia, and it's one of the best times in my opinion because things start looking really pretty and you start seeing how projects are progressing and ever looming is, I don't know about you, but I'm already planning for next year. Of course, I already know about you. Never mind. That's a stupid question. You have the next 4 years planned. So, it's summertime in the land of Morelia.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. I had a little photo shoot today. I was messing around with the new lens and took some cool shots, I think. But it's always fun messing around with that kind of stuff. But when you have babies, it's even more fun because now you're getting to see, like, you know, them growing and changing and, you know, so it's cool stuff. In this episode tonight, we're talking blood pythons and short-tailed pythons. And we're talking with Nick from Cold Blooded Earth, which is pretty cool. Now, I told you guys that about, what was it, 2 weeks ago? I guess it was 2 weeks ago. I got to go over to Matt Minatola's house and check out his collection. And what cool snakes. I never saw adults. You know, you go around a pet store. You go around a reptile show, and when you're walking around, you're kind of looking at things, and, you know, you can't really get an appreciation of what an adult looks like. And you know how much I love Burmese pythons and all, but, you know, so it's like I like that big snake feel, and they look like a big snake, but they're in a little package, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like...
They're a big snake that didn't get big enough. Hey, I got you. So they got the big snake attitude, but, man, adult bloods, I've seen a few. They look massive. I mean, they're just massive animals. They may not be long, but they're just huge compared to other snakes. They got these tiny heads, like someone shrunk down their head a little bit, too small for the rest of them, but they're just massive animals, and I heard they pack a punch when they get big if you piss them off, so you have fun with that.
to me, it didn't seem like, you know, Matt was showing me some of the different things that to look out for when it comes to bloods and short tails. But you know, for the most part, all his animals were pretty chill. You know, nothing was crazy, and everything was pretty chill. So anyway, you know, with talking to him, you know, seeing things, I kind of, you know, felt that I've always kind of felt that, like, the blood python, short tail python world was kind of like similar to, like, carpets and Morelia, but just on another spectrum, you know, because they're kind of like that little niche type of group, community. But man, what a difference between carpets and bloods, you know. It's like when you're used to dealing with carpets and scrubs and lean snakes with prehensile tails, and, you know, it's like, wow.
they can hold on to things and put up a fight when you have to move them. And then you go to a blood where it's just like, oh, there it goes. So, you know, I equate bloods to working with Gaboon vipers. I mean, they just kind of sit there, but two hooks, you know, one on their top, one around their midsection, and then the Gaboon viper's like, well, where are we going now? Because I can't do anything. So, you know, they're definitely very cool. And you have some good starters going on over there. You showed me your boy earlier this week, and I got crazy head pattern with I don't know if I'm not used to it or, like, really not used to analyzing them as close as I have carpet python, but it was insanity with the colors and stuff. So, keep working on that.
It's pretty cool.
You have my blessing there.
You know, as I started, you know, digging into the world of, I guess, I don't know if they're called the short tails or if they call them all short tails. We'll have to ask Nick when he comes on.
We'll ask. We can do this. We have a radio show.
The Curtis complex. You know, I don't know how they equate it. But, you know, as I started digging around, I see all these different types and morphs and lines. And I see a lot of parallels between them and chondros with just like the genetics are kind of like, it's not really, especially with Borneos, and again, I'm no expert, but this is at least what I've been told, is kind of like there's no real, it's not like, you know, breeding a jag to a coastal and you're going to get jags and coastals. It's kind of like, it's a little bit of a mix.
A little bit of a mystery here of what could happen.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm excited to talk to Nick. You know, he has some awesome animals, you know, just top-notch stuff. this past weekend was Northwest Carpet Fest.
I hear it got a little wild.
Yeah, Yeah, a little bit.
Apparently, we just get put to shame, apparently, over in the Northeast. So
it's not fair because we go first, so it's kind of like, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
I know, and then they know, and they know how to do it, and I mean, they know where to go and how to step and how to outdo us. So maybe we'll make them go first next year.
Yeah, well, I think they're. I don't know if this is a definite, but I think they're moving it to September because flights are cheaper, and they're really trying to get. Nick told me I had to go. It was mandatory.
You were. I think you must.
Northwest Carpet Fest was. I think they raised $1,500 for Rico and US Arc, which was.
That's amazing. That's great.
So that was a cool thing. And before we got Nick on, of course we have. Our segment of Reptile Insider, and tonight Robin's going to be joining us, and he's going to be talking about auctions, which I'm curious to see his thoughts on that, because I know in Morelia we don't really have too much of that stuff, but I got some thoughts on it, but you know, I want to hear his thoughts and some of the other different things, like you know, like Craigslist and trade shows and higher end shows, lower end shows, that kind of stuff. So you know, we'll be getting him. Actually, I don't know which one is him. I forget what
his
number is. And I got two guys here.
All right.
So Owen, you man the ship there for a second, and
I'll distract somebody somewhere with something. What I'll do is I'll just speak out loud. So, yeah. If anybody's in the Pennsylvania area, we're going to be at the Hamburg Reptile Show. Who doesn't love the Hamburg Reptile Show? Come on out. I'm there. Jason Balin's there. I don't know if Howard Redding or Mo from Mojo Reptiles are going to be there, but hopefully they will be, and that's always a fun time. Do you figure it out?
Yeah. I went over to the green room, and Robin's here now. So
we have a green room. Awesome.
Yeah, the secret room. So, hey, Robin, welcome to the show. And
hey, guys, thanks for having me back again this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Well, so I'm actually excited because I am a big Blood Python fan myself, so I'm anxious to hear all this Blood Python info and chit-chat.
Cool.
It's an awesome, awesome species.
Yeah, you guys
Eric,
quite a bit, right? Yeah,
we did albinos. I think we might have been the first in the U.S. to breed and hatch albino bloods. I mean, boy, this was back. Time flies, you know how that happens. It might have been in the 90s still, in the late 90s. And then we also did our own line of stripes, genetic stripes, and it gives me a smile every time I see blood folks out there working and producing stuff, and they say, you know, this is the Pro Exotics line of stripe and stuff. So that's our original line, and it's a really nice-looking animal. So, we've worked extensively with them for, more than 15 years. And like I said,
that's
one
awesome.
Of my favorite species. And physically, as you guys were saying, such an imposing and yet unusual species, being so thick and yet, you know, the head so small and tapers so quick, and you know, some have worse attitudes than others, but I always did enjoy working with them, and I think they're a gorgeous animal. I think they're really underappreciated in the hobby, but like I said, I'm always anxious to hear Blood Python talk, so I'll be looking forward to the rest of the show today.
Cool.
Yeah, we were when I went, I was talking that I went out to Matt Minatola's house, and he actually has a Pro Exotic stripe, and Owen, where do you see this animal? Oh, man. Man,
I will see you Friday.
Yeah.
They're stunning. Yeah, right on.
God. Good job. So tonight we're going to talk about reptile auctions, pros, cons. I know when you sort of hear people talk about it, some people hate it. I think it's the worst thing that ever happened. Some people think it's good, but you have to do it a certain way. So I'm curious to see what your take is on it, Robin.
Yeah, and I'm also curious to see, you know, last week we agreed on everything. I'm curious to see if this week we can disagree on anything.
Someone has
we
to
can
disagree.
Have some back and forth, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at it, it's a pretty complicated issue. I think the easiest way to discuss it, though, is to set aside something, and that would be like the U.S. ARC auctions that you know, Jordan Russell and Mike Clarkson were running. I think when you talk about, you know, hey, let's discuss reptile auctions, I think what people get emotional about and have strong feelings about are breeders and dealers just auctioning off animals and listing them up on Facebook or wherever. I don't think that very many folks have much of an issue with like the U.S. ARC auctions where 150 different breeders and vendors donate stuff to be auctioned off to raise money to protect the future of our hobby. So I'd like to go ahead and accept that right off the bat and say that, you know, when I'm talking about auctions, I'm more referring to, again, breeders and dealers auctioning off animals, say, on their Facebook page for their own as a sales outlet, you know. So that's what I'm talking about. And I mean, to boil it down to a couple few short words, I'm not a fan of auctions.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you guys fans of auctions?
Well, I would say this. Go ahead, Owen.
Go ahead. I think that I'm not a fan of them for the standpoint of you're kind of selling the animal short. My friend who breeds monitors needed a white-throat albicularis male. And one of the dealers had one up for auction, and that's easily a $900,000 animal because it was an adult male, ready to go. He got it on auction for, like, $200. So on one hand, I'm happy that my buddy got a really cool animal for really cheap. On the other hand, you just totally screwed yourself by putting it up on an auction. Why didn't you just sell it outright? Because you would have paid that money. So I don't like them, but I think you're ultimately screwing yourself. So knock yourself out. I mean, if you're going to take losses with animals with auctions by selling them for half of what they're worth, you're dumber than a sack of hammers. I mean, I can't help you. So my only concern is that it's
So far we kind of agree again. We're
so
not
far.
Fans.
Kind of.
But
kind of.
Let me here's what I learned though.
Uh-huh.
You know, once I was done with my pro exotics life, you know, we were a breeder for 20 years and we worked with all kinds of lizard species, geckos and snakes, a wide variety of stuff. Once I was done with that part of my reptile business life, I was able to look at the business and the hobby and the way things work and the market from a bit different perspective. I was able to step back, and it gave me a different perspective on things. So I'm not a fan of auctions, although I am a fan, if we can get into it, of a couple people's execution of auctions. I can admire what they're doing and achieving. But overall, I'm not a fan because it's not for me as a consumer. That's not how I'm going to find or source or purchase stock for myself. And I have, you know, and if I put myself in those shoes, I have breeding intentions. I'm not buying a pet. I'm not looking to buy a pet lizard that I'm going to name him Larry. I'm looking to buy breeding stock to further my goals as a breeder. That would be my, you know, intention.
Yeah.
So I'm not a fan. Like, that's not how I'm going to want to acquire animals. However, here's what I've learned with my perspective.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. What I like doesn't matter.
No one cares.
Sort of. I mean, well, some people care, but it doesn't matter. Whether I like auctions or not doesn't really matter that much. And here's why. There are vendors, breeders, sellers that sell to all different aspects of the market. There are very, very high-end boutique guys, and there are very, on the opposite end of the spectrum, there are folks that do so-called free rehoming type stuff on Craigslist, for example.
Yeah.
That's a wide variety of sellers. And the thing is, there's an incredibly wide variety of buyers that fits that exact same market.
True.
There are buyers that want to buy from boutique breeders. Somebody, Ben Rennick Reptiles, that is breeding just a few specific species and trying to produce the highest quality animals they can. Or a Greg Maxwell back in the day trying to breed a specific, you know, chondros and trying to sell the highest quality they can. Or Psychotic Exotics doing carpets and stuff. And uh-huh. On the other side, there are folks that just buy stock from wherever they can find it, including off of Craigslist or off their local newspaper or wherever it is, and then resell that stock through those same channels. So whether or not I like auctions is my own personal thought and feeling, and you know, I'm happy to chat folks up about it. But because I'm not a fan of auctions, I don't get confused. I used to be confused about it. I don't get confused anymore and think that they're going to go away because I don't like them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It's still going to exist. As if it leaves a bad taste in your mouth or a listener's mouth, I understand. I totally understand why it would. But just because you don't like it doesn't mean it can go away or it will go away or you can make it go away. Once I took a step back and understood, oh, there is a strong segment of the buying market that loves auctions.
Yeah.
I got an appreciation for not the auction process. I didn't say, oh, well, geez, I just never really appreciated it before, and I think auctions are rad. More so it's from a business perspective to say, oh, okay, I see that there's a clientele and a demand for that. And whenever there's a demand for something, well, somebody smart's going to get in there and supply it and do some business and make some money in the end. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of the auctions, but like I said, I can appreciate a couple of the folks that are able to do it well. And the example I always use when I'm discussing this is Ben Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing auctions on Facebook, and he's having wild success. And he's doing them very well. As far as, you know, success, he's moving a ton of product, a ton of animals, a wide, wide variety of stuff, and he's got a lot of buyers. He has the largest Facebook page by far. He just broke 200,000 yesterday, 200,000
yeah.
likes. I don't know anybody even remotely close to that. So, nope. Again, that goes back to, oh, you don't care for auctions, I don't care for auctions, you know, as kind of a whole face value kind of thing. There's 200,000 people that do like it.
Right.
So it does,
right.
It says something about the interest and demand for it. Now, here's the catch, though. Ben is very, very successful doing it. Nobody else really is that successful. Well, nobody else is that successful. And there's only a handful of people that have any kind of reasonable success. And I think that's where auctions get a bad name, is lots of folks want to do them and try and do them as a legitimate outlet for sales, or they're trying to move their slow stock that doesn't move otherwise, you know,
uh-huh.
or their lesser quality animals or something like that. And unfortunately, you just can't expect to have Ben Siegel's success when he's listing 30 to 60 animals every day he's listing and selling, and you're going to list one animal next Friday on an auction.
Yeah. Yeah,
for your
yeah, you
know,
that.
Page that has 5,000 likes, you're kidding yourself if you're expecting some similar result.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think people, you know, then you have the folks that say, oh, shit, I tried auctions and it was terrible, you know, it didn't work, and, you know, somebody offered me 10 cents on the dollar what it was worth. Well, yeah, that's because it's a hard gig. It's a hard thing to execute right. It is absolutely
yeah.
not for everybody. And, in fact, I would say it's really not for almost anybody. There's only a couple people that can do them. So it does make me not really sad, but it bums me out some to see lots of folks doing some auctions and getting really poor value on animals because, you know, as you guys mentioned earlier, that, boy, you're not doing anything there but beating yourself up. Mm-hmm. You know, you're investing all this time and money into your stock and into your animals, and you know, I'm expecting you're taking pride in what you're producing and getting it out there. And then yet you try an avenue, an untested avenue for yourself, and then you end up getting 30 cents on the dollar. You can't be happy about that. That's not, you know, for the other folks that are selling a similar species, a similar, you know, mutation or a particular animal, they're not going to be happy either because, in effect, you're beating up their price. So I can absolutely empathize with the folks that say it's bad for business, but at the same time, like I said, I try and keep a balance because I understand, boy, there is certainly demand from a strong segment of the buying public for it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my fear with reptile auction is, as you're talking, I'm putting thoughts in my head, so I'm just kind of speaking out loud. It's just, mm-hmm. For one, do you think that it puts reptiles in hands of people that where the price would keep them away, so they're sort of buying more than they should take on? You know what I mean? So, like, for instance, if you have 200 and, or let's say you have $500 and you want to go and you want to start a breeding project, well, if you can get X amount of animals because you bought it on an auction, you're not really thinking about, I don't know, I get the feel that that type of consumer is not, they're not thinking long term. They're buying on a whim, which ultimately, what happens to that animal? Where does that animal go? It gets passed along, you know, from person to person. And I guess, what are your guys' thoughts on as far as it affecting the price of animals? Is that something that you see? Because I guess for me personally, I'm dealing in higher end carpet, so it's kind of like I'm in a different game than in the lower. You know what I mean? So I'm not selling that type of animal. So I don't know. Does it affect the price? I mean, is it dropping because they sold it on an auction for X amount of money?
I think it could if it's lower-end stuff. The problem is that a lot of the stuff that I've seen where people want to build up projects, they're not going to, you know, they say you're into carpet pythons. You might get your first carpet python off an auction, but your second and third ones are you're eventually going to start going to breeders. Because you want quality stuff, you want high dollar value or your stuff, and you want to have the good-looking stuff. You know, you're not – normally the animals that are in the auction are, you know, ball python this, boa that, you know, a lot of stuff that's already been kind of – and it's not like high dollar, really expensive stuff. It's kind of lower or middle-of-the-road stuff because then it's like – yeah, I can get a great deal, but if I'm actually going for a high-dollar value stuff, you know where to go. You're not going to go get it off of an auction.
And I guess my other thought is this, is that, Robin, you would probably be able to tell us more than anybody because you've bred reptiles for a living. Isn't there a period when you're sort of like when babies are just coming into age and your stock from the previous year is kind of gone, so you're going through like a slow type of period? I mean, if you're a breeder and you're doing it as a business, I would think that you would plan for that. So what I think maybe sometimes what I've heard from people is that they're nervous, they're not selling anything, they quick throw it up on the auction, try to sell it, now they're selling it for cheaper. If they just would have been a little more patient with it, they probably would have got a higher dollar amount for it. Because let's face it, with you're doing an auction and you're buying, you have to have that money right there in your hand in order to get that animal. At that time, you know?
I should have started writing some notes because you guys glanced over about three topics right there.
Sorry, yeah, we do that.
I'll pick up the most recent one.
Go ahead.
So do some sellers, do they get impatient and resort to an auction and sell something for less than, number one, what it's worth? And number two, what they could have gotten with a little more patience. Wasn't that what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really somebody's I can't blame folks for doing that because we're in a hobby-based business. So a lot of folks are breeding animals on the side, not as their main source of income. If breeding reptiles is your main source of income, you're not going to be successful or in business for very long if you don't have some long-term strategies for success. And freaking out during or not anticipating the slow period, like you mentioned, you're going to put yourself out of business. Blowing out your stock for less than what you have into it, you're going to put yourself out of business. So the business folks, I think, are a bit better able to handle that and prepare for that. And, yes, we always had, you know, with ProExotics, yeah, you certainly have slow periods of the year. Usually, you know, you try and have your production kind of taper off just as the new hatchlings are coming on. And if you plan exactly right, then that happens. And otherwise, yeah, we might not have really anything for sale for a couple of months. However, the reptile world is dominated by a lot of hobbyist breeders.
Right.
And they already have a 9-to-5 gig that they do every day, a regular job that is their source of income. And the reptile part is the passion part, and it happens to make some money. But as you were getting to, if things take a downturn or, you know, shit, I need $300 by next week, well, then that pressure becomes more of a priority instead of, hey, what's the proper business sensibility for this? And it's funny you guys bring it up because it was just 2 or 3 days ago I saw on the JD Constriction page, John Degg, he's a ball python breeder, he posted up, he said, the funniest thing with these wacky reptile business folks, you know, somebody had posted up these animals, their price list, 10 days ago, and it had these animals at these prices, and they posted it on their page one time. He said, I saw them repost the price list today, and it said everything 20% cheaper.
Jesus.
Oh, wow.
So,
that's going to hell of a fire sale.
Right. He said, I don't understand the if I knew we were going to talk about it, I would have pulled up the post. But you can go to the JD Constriction page or the John Degg page. I forget exactly where he posted it, but it should be up there. But he said, you know, I don't understand the philosophy, the business philosophy behind this. You posted up your price list one time. You didn't promote it. You didn't market it. You didn't put the animals out there. You didn't let it reach your audience. And instead, you immediately turned around and slashed prices 20%. You're cutting your own throat in that case.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of maybe a hobbyist, and I don't know who he was talking about. I didn't look up the specific price list. But that's an example of maybe a hobbyist freaking out about being short on sales in a very, very short time period instead of thinking more of the long term.
Uh-huh.
And that certainly can cause trouble, and that gets – that kind of mentality can cause issues with the auction thing. You know, as far as auctioning off lower-value animals, I do see folks trying to use auctions as a way to move, like I said, animals that aren't moving otherwise. But at the same time, you know, I also – going back to Ben Siegel as an example, you know, he's auctioning off $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 animals, and he's doing pretty well with it. I've talked to him at length about this kind of stuff. And that's a lot of people that want to beef about auctions and say, I hate auctions and they ruin the market. It's because they say, oh, it brings down the price of the animal. But I'm not sure that's totally fair. I know that we're in a very hard marketing slump or market slump right now. I mean, certainly if you're in the ball python market, it's very, very difficult right
now.
You know, when you're in a more niche market, a boutique market, doing, you know, carpets or specific boas or, you know, frogs or lizards or something else, it's different. But ball pythons are very, very soft. So are they soft because Ben Siegel's doing auctions? I don't think that's why they're soft. I think auctions are popular because the market is soft. But talking with Ben the other day, he told me that he sells pastel ball pythons for auction. He puts them up. And he says sometimes they're crappy animals, kind of dull and you know, not very colorful. And he says sometimes they are superstar, you know, animals that really pop. And he said, you know, I sold a pastel male the other day for $150. And I'm guessing you could probably pick them up all day long for $50 right now for,
right,
you know, reasonably nice ones. But he said it was a really nice animal, And for that animal, at that moment, there was a number of bidders willing to compete to get their hands on that specific great-looking animal. He said,
right,
the next day we sold a mediocre pastel animal, essentially the same thing, just not as pretty, for $35 through the auction.
Mm-hmm.
So 35 is pretty cheap, although
mm-hmm.
You can pick them up all day long for $50. But if you go to wholesalers that are producing tens of thousands of animals, you can probably get pastels for $15 in quantity.
Right.
But 35 was soft. But at the same time, he said, "Yeah, shit, I sold one for $150, which is spectacular right now."
Yeah.
For a pastel. So he's seen mixed results. I mean, some animals bring very strong price. A lot of times they bring over market price. And then sometimes they're very soft and they bring underprice. And he says, sometimes it surprises the crap out of me because I think it's going to bring $500 and it only brings $125. But, that's how some of the unpredictability of the auction goes. But I don't think auctions themselves weaken the price of the animals. I think inactive auctions weaken the price of the animals. Again, if you've only got 5,000 likes on your page or a small audience and you put up an animal, you can't expect to have the same type of bidding and activity that Bob Clark gets on his page or Mike Wilbanks gets or Ben Siegel gets. These guys that have cultivated these really large audiences, it just isn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And to speak to that, again, I saw a post by a boa breeder the other day, does designer boa stuff, and I watched kind of the progression of it, and he had said, due to popular demand, we're going to be doing some auctions. Mm-hmm. And he had a reasonably sized page. And, sure enough, a couple weeks later, he made a post, and he says, "Look, I don't know what happened here, but I had the impression that everybody wanted auctions. When I actually put auctions up, there wasn't anybody bidding, and the animal sold for nothing, and I'm not doing that."
Yeah.
And that goes back to, if you don't have the audience, which very, very few people do, the auction's not going to be a viable thing for you. And it seems like many people have to learn that lesson firsthand before they walk away from it. They're thinking, "Oh, mine's going to be different. I'll put these, rad animals up, and I'll get super great value and high bidding." And then two people bid on it. One's a 12-year-old in Colombia, and the other one, bid $13. And you're committed to sell now. You're $300 animal for $13.
You did it, so
And that guy wants a discount on shipping. So, it's just not what you think it's going to be. So, again, my resistance to auctions is more so from a consumer point of view. That's not how I'm going to build my group. That's not how I'm going to put my group together, by picking up whatever random animals happen to be up. As you guys said before, I'm going to the best breeder I can find. I'm going to talk to him about what stock he has. I'm going to look for specific sexes. I'm going to look for specific traits. I'm going to look for the best possible animal I can get. That's how I want to put together a collection.
Right.
Not just but randomly bidding on some shit that's for sale on Tuesday.
Yeah. My experience,
Tuesday,
My experience is when you're going to you're going to your local reptile show, that's exactly what people want. They want the cheapest animal that they can possibly get. They don't want to put any thought into, this one's going to grow up to be a screaming adult and make screaming babies. It's $5 cheaper, and they're going to get it from there. And then I guess on a national level, my experience has been a little bit different, because there you got people that are coming from all over the U.S., sometimes the world, to come and check out what's going on, because you got all your top breeders there. And, they're kind of like, you're seeing the creme de la creme, so to speak. And, I don't know. It's kind of, that's one of my biggest frustrations with the reptile hobby, is that people would rather go chintzy. And, we talk about it all the time on the show. And just like you just said, if you have quality stock, you're going to have quality babies, and that's what it's going to set you apart,
right,
among other things, between this person and that person, So,
and it goes back to the same thing. There's a show clientele. There are customers and buyers that only want to buy from their show. There's folks that only want to buy from their local show in Poughkeepsie. You know, they're not traveling to a Tinley or a super show or some large, you know, big regional show where you have national vendors coming and a wide selection, like you said. I mean, you go to Tinley, there's, you know, there's a, well, if you're into ball pythons, there's a great selection. You know, if it's a particular year when they do carpet row, then there's also going to be some, you know, a great representation of Morelia stuff there. But, yeah, if you go to Beaumont, Montana, and that's your local show, and you're like, well, I'd rather pick it out in person, you know, than get sight unseen. Okay. There are people that insist on doing that. Like in Colorado, we never really had strong shows. Now we have a couple shows. Repticon comes through once in a while. Rocky Mountain Reptile Expo is here a few times a year, and that's run by local folks. But back in the 2000s and in the 1990s, there wasn't a local show. I mean, they were very, very small. And I would still encounter folks say, oh, yeah, I'm going to wait and see what I can find at the show. And I would say, geez, you have access to the best breeders across the country. You could talk to anybody in the country you want. They could have it shipped here, you know, within a day. Why wouldn't you just go that way and get, again, the best possible animal? And it's because I'm so dumb, I think everybody thinks like me, and that's the mistake. That's why I said it doesn't matter what I think, because my motivation is different than their motivation. Their motivation isn't to pick up the best possible animal. They want to pick up something locally they can see in person, and then they can haggle with the vendor and say, you know, oh, it's $50, how about I give you $43? That's their experience they want. That's the customer they want. And it's kind of, you know, dumb of me to think that they have to automatically be like me and say, oh, well, you know, screw that approach. I want to go to the, you know, very best single animal I can find. It doesn't work the same for everybody. So, again, while I wouldn't, you know, wait until October for the local show to roll around so I can try and pick up some stock, there are certainly users and buyers and that segment of the market, that's exactly what they're going to do.
Right. Well, damn it, we agreed again.
Yeah.
We'll find something.
We'll have to have a show about guns or religion or politics or something. I mean, you know, it can degrade into some, you know, pissing match, and
there you go.
We could try and fight each other over the phone.
I like that. That's a great idea. That sounds like a great show. We should save that for the Christmas episode.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think to kind of wrap the topic up, I mean, whether it's auctions or it's local shows or it's classifieds or Craigslist, like I said, I think I gained a greater appreciation and understanding of the market when I was able to take a step back and recognize that not everybody was the same, and their motivation is not the same. Like I said, there's a wide variety of vendors serving all different segments of the market. And that dude that shows up at your local show, and he's got a 20-gallon tank full of 15 scrawny Savannah monitors, that's not for me. But there is a customer for him. There's a customer for that guy. And that's the reality of it. I mean, I don't like it, and, you know, it's not my thing, and it hurts my heart a little bit to see a bunch of scrawny monitors. But there's a customer for that guy, and he's not there by accident. He's there because every show he goes and does that, and he makes money.
Sure.
Even though there's high-end breeders maybe clustered around or spread through the rest of the building, they're making money selling to their customers. This guy's making money selling to his customers. So, yeah, it doesn't have to be my particular flavor, but at this point I can recognize that, oh, it does exist. And so what am I going to do about it? Now, if I'm still selling animals, which I'm not anymore, but if I was still selling animals – then what do you do with that information? You take it and think, okay, now that I have a little bit better perspective on it, what can I do better to reach my segment of the market? Or maybe I widen my scope a little bit and try and reach a larger segment of the market. I don't want to go all the way over to this far end, but maybe, you know, maybe I expand my reach and appeal a little bit to try and pull in a little bit bigger audience. You know, there's ways to put that information to use, but, you know, standing around pointing your finger saying, you know, this guy sucks or auctions suck and they're terrible or this and that, you know, it doesn't do anybody a lot of good. But to understand that there's buyers in each of those segments, I think it makes you stronger overall in your understanding of the market and your ability to manipulate your own efforts and benefit from it overall, if commercial benefit is your point in the end anyways.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, good point. I forget what our topic is for next week, but I'm going to have to think about the...
I have a list.
Oh, okay.
Oh, good.
You have the list?
Awesome.
I can tell you.
We didn't come prepared.
You have me for one more segment, and then you'll have
okay.
Chad for a couple. But next week is tips on how to promote your reptile business.
Sweet.
Cool. Well, the
so
cool thing about next
kind
week,
of ties into this kind of stuff.
Kind
yeah,
of, the, a little
we'll,
bit.
We'll go. Mm. We can go a little more in depth next week because next week there's no guests, so it's kind of it's open, so we can talk as long as we'd like. So.
Sweet.
Right. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
Thanks
right.
for having me on
Thanks
again, guys. And like I said, I'm looking forward to hearing about blood pythons.
Yep,
all right.
On the line. I'm going to click them on and get it going. All right. Thanks,
Robin. Thanks, Robin.
All right. Have a great show. We'll talk to you next week.
All right.
Okay. So, without further ado, let's get Nick on here. Hey, Nick. Welcome to the show, Cold-Blooded Earth. Sorry about running a little late there, but better
late than
never.
Sometimes you ramble.
Yeah. How's it going?
Hey, guys. Hey. Good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, great. Yeah, that was a really good discussion, and I'm glad I was able to listen to that.
Cool. So, Nick, why don't we just get rolling without delaying, and why don't you tell us about yourself and what got you started in the reptiles?
Okay, well, I guess my story is like most people's stories. Started when I was young. Caught my first snake when I was 3, and then the rest was kind of history. You know, it's when people ask me, you know, why reptiles, I just something I was born with. You know, that's the only explanation I really have for it.
Uh huh. Okay. So, like, were you just like wandering around the woods, or did your parents take you out and you found the snake, or and were
yeah,
they kind
I mean,
of cool with it when you showed up
of,
with it?
Well, there was a little bit of both. You know, my parents were real encouraging with the whole thing, and, you know, I would go out and catch snakes with my dad and stuff, so, you know, from a young age, it was very encouraged, never discouraged.
Cool. That you got better than some of us, so.
yeah, I guess it's a little bit more rare than most.
Yeah, well, it happens. Anyway, so what brought you to bloods and short tails above some of the other animals out there?
Well, I had a pretty diverse collection for a long time. You know, I had Bolins and Olives and Timors, Helmaharas and all kinds of different
Jeez.
Stuff.
Man, that's pretty far away from blood, so all right.
Yeah, it is. It is. But, you know, I got my first blood, and then I saw Dave and Tracy's talk down in Daytona, I guess, 2004 or 2005. And, you know, I was hooked. It was just like, that's, to me, it's like the perfect snake. Like you guys were talking about initially in the beginning, it's a big snake in a small package. And, you know, that really has an appeal to me. And, you know, just the color and pattern variation. And, I mean, there's just so much. So, you know, I started to phase out a lot of my collection just to focus on the bloods because I figured having, a lot of one species I'd end up being more successful with it than if I had just a pair of this and a pair of that. So that was kind of the process of getting my collection to where it is today.
Cool. So can you give us a brief overview of what you got going on there collection-wise? You know, what are some of your favorites?
Well, Golden Eyes are right up there, and I mean, they're just beautiful. It's
yeah,
you know, a lot of that cream color and red, and they just bring a good mix of color and pattern into it. I really like stripe stuff. You know, there's stripes in the reds, and there's stripes in the Borneos.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that stuff too. And just, you know, I mean, with the bloods, it's, you know, if you don't like morphs, you can go just, you know, the classic red or black. I mean, it just offers a lot. And then if you start infusing the really nice, you know, quote-unquote normals into the pattern mutations and color mutations, you just get a better snake.
Cool. I mean, I've seen the golden eyes a little bit. I'm not really, you know, delved too deep into them. That's Eric's one who's been diving head first into the blood python pool. So, but I have seen them.
Golden eyes are the best, man.
There you are, right on cue. That's awesome. So,
yeah, they're incredible. Yeah. They're really incredible. I mean, it's like anything. You need to see it in person, you know.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. It's, once I see something in person and, like, hold it, I'm like, I got to get three of these. So I'm trying to put some distance between me and Eric at this moment when he's on this blood python kick. Otherwise, I'm going to end up with, like, three. So
well, that would be all right.
Well, yeah, I mean, what are you complaining about? Yeah, so you shall see.
Okay. So just I figure because – we have mostly people that keep carpets, chondros, scrubs, and whatnot. And maybe just give us a basics of first of all, let's put it this way: how do you what do you go by? What are they? Bloods and short tails, or are they just short tails? The Curtis complex. What do people call them?
I always use blood and short tails just to, you know, differentiate between red bloods, which, you know, so it's just your bloods, and then you have your Sumatra short tails, which a lot of people refer to as blacks, and then you have your Borneo short tail. So I kind of break it up into those two things.
Okay. And now I heard, I don't know, maybe you can tittle on this a little bit, but I heard that there's a fourth species now. Is that true?
Yeah, I've heard that. To be honest, I haven't really looked into it much. I just saw the picture of it. And read a little bit about it, I guess. I mean, from the picture, it just looked like a yellow blood, but I guess through the genetic work that was done, they determined it was a fourth species, so, which is kind of exciting.
Okay, so these are all species, they're not subspecies, because they used to be subspecies, right?
Yeah, they were all under Curtis, and then in 2001, they were broken up into three different species.
Okay. All right. And I know this is kind of jumping all over the place, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about their, like, natural history. Like, when these guys are in the wild, where are they at, and, you know, where would you find them?
In low-lying marshlands, you know, you see them a lot in swamps, slow-moving water. I guess where it would stay a little bit cooler than, but they, you know, not up in the mountain ranges or anything. But they do spend a lot of time in the water, and, you know, floodplains.
Okay.
That kind of, you know, marshy kind of area, I guess, that you would think of them, you know, sitting in.
Okay. All right. One of the things that I'm still kind of confused about is, okay, so we're talking about Sumatrans, and they're the black bloods. Now, you have some that have the orange head and some that have the black head, or is it called the chrome head? Is that the right name for that?
Well, the chrome and the black is pretty, I mean, that's the same. That's just a color variance. Some black heads are chrome during certain, you know, hours during the day, and then they go black, and it's just, you know, just a slight variance, but they're... the work hasn't been done yet, but Tracy Barker is actually going to do a genetic study between the orange heads and then the other larger Sumatran, the blackhead.
Oh, so there's a difference in size?
There's a difference in size. And then obviously, I mean, that's a pretty big contrast just for, you know, having – the orange head, and the body looks different. The pattern is a little bit different.
Okay.
That kind of stuff.
Cool.
Are they found in the same area, or are they in different, like, do they overlap, or is it just they're separated by?
Well, in general, the orange head is found in the northwest coast. So Sumatra is divided by a mountain range. So what you end up having is in the south west coast, basically, is where you're going to end up having the black bloods. So the northwest part of that range is where you find the orange heads. And then to the north of that mountain range is where you end up getting your red bloods. So that ridge divides the island of Sumatra in half.
Okay. Huh. Okay. Interesting. Go ahead, Owen.
Cool. So now with caging, because, you know, again, we normally don't ever have blood python breeders on. So normally we all hear about neonate and caging and stuff for very long, thin snakes. So can you give us a rundown of caging for neonates?
For neonates, I use all of my cage systems are racks from Animal Plastics. So for babies, I use your standard shoebox size. And then I just use paper towels and a water bowl. Really, really simple, basic setup. And then from there, once they get established, start putting on some size, I move them up into the CB70, which is your, standard ball python breeder bin. And then I have some males that are small enough to live in there, even when they come into breeding size. But the females I move up to their VE175 rack. It's that big Christmas tree tub storage container.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
So move them up into that.
Yeah, I just move them up to that, and that way I can put in a big water bowl and a nest box, and having two, pretty heavy-bodied snakes in there, they take up a lot of room.
I can understand that. Okay. So now, what would you do heat-wise for everybody? What's the ideal temperature, and how do you go about heating the cage? Because I know with some of my guys, we have heat panels on the top of the cage. Would you prefer under the cage heat for these guys?
I have under the cage heat for my baby bins, but Animal Plastics offers a dual side radiant heat. So the snake never actually has to sit on the heat. It's kind of like, it's the same idea as a radiant heat panel, that it's coming, from the top, but this is coming from the sides. So it's a little bit more natural, and they're not actually just sitting on heat, I don't like to have my snakes do that. And in my snake room, for the ambient temperature is about, 82 degrees most of the time, but I only keep my adults at 84, 85. They don't do well real hot.
Okay. So they're colder guys.
Yeah. They get stressed. That's when you see some problems start to arise. They just, you can tell that they get, real agitated if they're kept too warm. So I like to, 84, 85. It just seems to work out, better that way. And babies start eating. I was just feeding some of my new hatchlings today, and the snake room's right about 84, so I don't even have any heat on them right now. They're just, at the ambient temperature of the room, and they're doing really well.
Cool. So with the, we already established that the cage sizes, so you basically just bins and racks all the way around for these guys,
mm-hmm.
right? For you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay.
Cool. They're a shy snake that needs to feel secure all the time. So, no display cases for them or anything. It's just, they don't need a ton of space either. So if you take a little small blood python and you move it up into a big cage, it's not going to eat. They feel really uncomfortable. So a lot of times I'll have, yearling snakes in that shoebox rack, and if I move them into that CB70, they go off food. So, it takes a little bit longer.
Okay. That sounds eerily familiar to some of that crap I got to deal with. So, I understand. So, when it comes down to the movement over, when do you, I usually try to save it to, there's no room in this bin for this baby anymore. In the baby rack, because it's just that big now. No more space. Is that usually what you do? Is you kind of wait out until it's like, dude, I can't close the drawer because you're this big now. So
yeah, exactly. Like you know, when they coil, yeah. you can't shut the drawer when they're eating because they're coiled up too high.
Coiled up, yeah. When they're all coiled up, you can't shut the drawer. Okay. That's usually when I'm like, all right, it's time for you to get out of the baby box. So, okay. I'm glad that transfers over to other species of python.
Yeah, there you go. So, they're all set.
Yeah. There we go. So, yeah, just by 12 now. Are there any other special requirements that you can see with these guys? I like the idea of that they're a shy snake and they need to hide.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I've definitely experienced with my white lips, and they don't want to see me. They don't ever want to see me. So is there any other special requirements that you feel that these guys that somebody should know who wants to get into these guys?
Well, along the lines of that, you know, if you are moving up a snake and it does go off feed, but, you know, it can't stay in that small bin anymore, I just put a piece of newspaper down just for something for them to go under. You know, just a little fix like that works. And then, you know, with handling is a different ball game than I guess what a lot of your listeners are probably used to, because these are heavy-bodied snakes that don't like to be up off the ground. Big difference.
Okay.
You know, it's not like a carpet python, which is perfectly fine, you know, 10, 20 feet up off the ground. These snakes are just, they require a lot of support to feel secure. And that's
right.
A lot of times you see people that are new into it, and they're just, you know, handling it like a different, you know, like a corn snake or a carpet python, and the snake turns around and whack, tags them. It's just that snake is really uncomfortable and has no other way to tell you you're doing it wrong, you know?
Yeah, I guess it would be blood pythons don't want to be in a tree. No, it's not supposed to be in a tree. So you put it in one, it's going to be a little freaked out. That makes somewhat sense to me. So, all right.
So it's just, you just have to...
Go ahead. I was going to say, what would be the suggestion you would say for handling these guys? Like, what's the difference?
Yeah.
You know, just as much of the body that you can support, the better. They're not going to move around a lot, you know. It's just not their nature, really. So if you just, you know, scoop them up and support them as much as you can, that's the best thing. You know, don't put them around your neck or just, you know, hold it out with your hand. Just, you know, really... give that snake the support that it needs. And, you know, over time, you'll feel it. You know, it'll, like, that feeling will be different. It'll be more natural, the handling of them. And you can see them, you know, their eyes start moving back and forth. And, you know, and they'll tell you when they've had enough, that's for sure.
they'll let you know when they're pissed. Okay. So... Gotcha. Now, what are your thoughts when it comes to their humidity requirements? I know that people are saying that they do like it a little bit more swampy and damp, and then I've kind of heard the opposite, that it's not really needed. So where do you kind of sit when it comes to misting, and do you think it's a connection to the upper respiratory infections these guys can get?
Well, I can just, you know, only speak from my experience, but my snake room's about 60% humidity. In the winter, it dips down a little bit, so I'll run a humidifier. But, you know, I just put a large water bowl in the cage, and then I'll only mist, you know, that day or two right before they shed, you know, when their eyes clear and you know, they're right on that edge. I'll just mist them real quick, real light, just to make sure they get a nice clean shed. But other than that, I don't miss very often at all. I think that the humidity thing is it's not necessarily true.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure what you guys keep, you know, your carpets at and that stuff. But, you know, when I was first transitioning over to bloods and I had all that stuff, everything was pretty much the same, you know, and I, knock on wood, have very little respiratory issues at all.
Okay. I think that humidity is the most misunderstood thing in the reptile keeping world. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
I don't know.
There's a difference between being wet and humid.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
I mean, I think that if oversaturation is where you're going to, you know, you're going to get mold,
then
you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
what I found, and I don't know if this is true, this would be what you're saying, is that I have a certain scrub python that always has trouble shedding. And I don't know why this one does have a trouble and all the other ones don't, but for whatever reason it does. And it seems like right before it's going to go, I don't know if it's the dry heat that's in the room or what, but it seems that that milky substance, you know, dries up before it has a chance to shed, and then I get bad sheds. But if
right.
you just sort of miss the tub right before it's going to shed, you know, for whatever reason, it keeps that milky substance from drying up, and you're good to go, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's, it's easy enough to do, and that way, you know, you're not dealing with a snake that you have to soak, and, you know, your cages mm-hmm. aren't real wet and all that. So it's just, I always just put, I know it's cheesy, but I just put a little piece of blue tape on the outside of each animal that I know that's in shed, just so I can go in there and hit them real quick and know exactly which ones are in their shed cycle. So it makes it just easy to look at and just hit them, and then you're done.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if I was jumping in there on you, Owen.
No, I think we covered it, and I think we're good. So I think you're up now.
Okay. So when it comes to these guys because of their size, like what size is the heat spot that you're given is like a 13-inch heat tape, or is it?
It's 11-inch.
11-inch, okay.
Yeah, on both sides.
On both sides,
rack,
okay.
Right, so they're, and it's just, you know, those tubs are like 54 inches deep, so just the, you know, back, I guess, third is heated. But, it, you know, with the dual side rating heat like that, it's really just heating the air around there and not actually, they're not actually sitting on anything.
Gotcha. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the morphs of these guys. So, I see a lot of parallels with the carpets. Different species have different morphs. So let's just get this out of the way right now. It's pretty much a no-no to cross anything, right?
Yeah, let's just knock this out, Pee Pee.
You can't do that, right? It's like you get shunned and you're told your blood python breeding card is taken away and you go stand in
the
corner.
Wow.
Wow. It's over.
We think that you're serious. Jeez.
Yeah.
There's the comparisons are there. Especially, you know, like you were talking about earlier with the Borneos. The Borneo stuff is tough. So I guess, you know, we can start there and then move on to the other couple.
Yeah, Borneos are kind of like, to me, I don't know, you're going to go a little more in depth, but it seems to me like there's, again, with I equate them to similar to what you see in chondros, where it's like no set thing. You're just kind of like breeding and out pops these crazy-looking ones, and if you breed a crazy-looking one to another crazy-looking one, you get even crazier-looking ones. So maybe you can just run down, like, what is the different morphs and what is the same, like marble and granite, they're the same but different lines, that kind of stuff.
All right. Well, marble and granite's a good place to start. Granite will show up kind of randomly, like a lot of the Borneo stuff. But as far as I'm concerned, marble is recessive. So that's actually one that, you know, you can actually breed for. But the granite, I mean, I produced some granites this year from doing granite super stripe to granite super stripe that are just, I don't even know what to call them. I mean, they're unbelievable. But, again, it goes back to what you were saying that, you know, it's breeding one crazy thing to one crazy thing. I mean, and just, like, it brings it up a level. So a lot of the Borneo stuff, to me, I see in levels. Like, Ultra Bright and the Ghost and the Latte stuff, which is all essentially the same trait, but just the line breeding was different by the people that were developing them. But you'll see stuff that's, you know, near patternless and stuff that has a little bit of pattern and then a little more pattern, but it's all under that Ultra Bright Ghost Latte title. So When I'm looking at something like that, to me there's like four levels of it, if that makes sense.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know,
it's not the easiest of traits, and it's definitely not the easiest thing to describe because there is so much color and pattern variation in these animals. Like if you look at, like, you know, what Matt Minatola did with his ocelots, I mean, those are unbelievable. Do you get to see those?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they're nuts.
I mean, that's crazy. You know,
yeah.
So it's, and the, you know, again, there's, it looks like, you know, there's different levels of that trait as well. It's just, there's no real clear cut. Like, if I breed this to a normal, all the offspring are going to be heads. It's just, with a lot of them, it doesn't work that way.
Okay. So
you
is
know,
it more of a polygenic type of situation, or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would describe it that way. You know, because it's just, and you can have two, you know, normal-looking animals, you know, throw ultras, or you could do two super stripes and throw ultra super stripes. It's just, you know, it's kind of what makes breeding Borneos a blast.
Right.
I really, every clutch is just so different, and all the babies are so different. So it's just, you know, the Borneos are unbelievable when it comes to that kind of, like, you don't know what you're going to get. You just don't. I mean, you can try and you know, you'll have some idea of what's going to come out of there, but once they hatch, you're just like, wow. There's going to be an animal or multiple animals that just, you know, blows you away.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the granite super stripe clutch that you had, and is that the one that kind of has like the, I'm going to say it looks like a leopard almost. It's like a, like dots on it, kind of, like that crazy.
Down the dorsal and then all the speckling side.
Yeah. Yeah, that's wild, man.
Yeah, that's not what I mean, again, I didn't know what to expect, so I shouldn't say that's not what I was expecting because I just didn't know.
Huh. Wow.
You know.
So.
And when that,
so are there different lines that produce different result? I mean, are you seeing, is it consistent at all, or is it just, I mean, are you seeing, I guess with like stripe stuff, you're always going to get some form of stripe and.
Right. You know, there's different lines of stripe. Karen Ryan at the Blood Cell have one, and that's what I used in my granite super stripe to granite super stripe clutch was offspring from one of their blonde super stripes, which is just a really nice light animal with a little bit of granite fleckling and a, just a killer stripe. So it's just, I can't put my finger on it.
Right.
You know, because it's just, there's so much going on with them. Like, even each trait, you know, because, you know, you can breed just, you know, two super stripes and produce stripe ultras or something, you know. And I did that blonde super stripe to, it's a genetic stripe female that came out of the wild. And I ended up producing a snake that was so dark and had this cherry red head, and the sibling to it was bright yellow, full stripe. I mean,
wow.
You know.
That's pretty cool.
So that, it's definitely not cut and dry, that's for sure. And, you know, I think some of it goes to just what blood pythons, their natural colors are, because you get so much variability. And I think that plays into it for sure.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean,
so,
no golden eyes. And reds look the same. I mean, just there's this variability through every clutch and every snake.
So do you guys breed, like, different morphs through different lines? Like, let's say that you have, like, I know this is jumping into the bloods, but, like, I heard of something called the Red Bull line. Is that just, like, from, is that descended from wild caught stock, and they just tried to make it as red as they could? Is that so? It's just a natural.
It was just Al Brown did that pairing a couple years back, and it was just wine breeding for really nice red stuff, stuff that like Kevin Martyr and Karen Ryan are doing. It's just line breeding to make the best natural example of what that snake can look like. So
right.
when I go to do a morph pairing, I like to use the best, example of that I can. So it's not just like, oh, I'm going to take this awesome-looking Goldeneye and throw it to, a brown snake, because it takes away from the snake,
Right.
I'm not going to, because the quality isn't the same. So when you're using something like a really, really nice red female and throwing even an albino to it, your head albinos are going to be that much nicer, and then your albinos are going to be that much nicer. It really, the line breeding stuff makes a difference. If you look at the cherry bomb albinos or the red X stuff or any of that, it's, the T-positive albinos have had, 20 years of line breeding done to them, and some of it really, really shows.
Yeah. When I was looking at Matt's stuff, again, he was showing me some of the different lines and of that, and you could see a difference. And, one thing is that when I see pictures of T-negative albinos of the Bloods, I was never really a fan, but when I saw it in person, man, they were killer. I was like, that is wild, It's pictures just don't do it justice for me. But when you see it in person, you're like, you can't believe it. A python is this color. It's just crazy,
Yeah, it's unbelievable. They scream. And again, the T-negative stuff is just on the scene. So it's, there's a lot of stuff to be done with them there, I bred my T-negative this year to a really nice red female that I got from Karen Ryan, and all the babies are just, they hatched red, and that's what you're trying to do, my thing is, I'm not going to breed two snakes together if the offspring don't look better than the parents.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So using those really nice red females, it really shows. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, I guess one of the things that I noticed as I was, sort of popping into the blood world is, it seems like you guys are very careful about what you mix, like just what you were just saying. It's like what you're mixing with what and what you're putting with what. It seems like you guys are dialed into that, at least from the people that I've seen. And I guess it's like, let me ask you this: with the Bloods, is it a little more cut and dry, or are you getting curveballs the same as Borneos when you're breeding Bloods?
It's a little bit more cut and dry, because you're working with recessive traits or codon like Ivory or Goldeneye. So it is a little bit more, you know what to expect. But again, there's just, I go back to the variability. It's like some of them, for Goldeneyes, for example, it's like, do you like them really patternless, or do you like a lot of pattern in them? Because you're going to get the whole spectrum across the board, which is, it makes the snake, for me, like really desirable, because there's something in it for everyone. It's not just,
sure.
You're not just going to have a patternless white snake every single time.
Right.
So there's just a lot to that, but the Bloods are definitely a bit more cut and dry.
Okay. So what are some of the more, so we talked about the Goldeneye, and when you breed a Goldeneye to a Goldeneye, you're getting a Magpie?
Yep,
right?
Which is almost an all-white snake with these black dots on it, and as that snake grows over time, the neck and the first, two-thirds of that snake start to get orange and pink. They're just...
What?
Yeah, they're outrageous.
How is that?
Oh, and you've never seen one of them?
No!
You've never seen one?
Apparently, I just suck.
I got to post it up, man. Oh, my God.
Wow,
you
have to. That sounds crazy.
Yeah, it's just like, I can't even describe it to you. It doesn't do it justice
that
at all.
That drastic of a color change is ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, that's another thing with these snakes that, you know, some snakes, the best they look is when they come out of egg. But these snakes, it's like as they age and grow, you know, when they hit 3 and 4 or 5 years old, they get better and better and better. You know, so it can be hard to pick a hold back. And trust me, I've sold some that I was like, oh, good. I should have known that.
Yeah, man. Seller's remorse. Yeah, it hits us all. So.
Yeah. So it just makes it's another fun aspect of working with these snakes and breeding them and raising them up. Just, you know, always changing, and they're just perfect.
Right. Mm. I see a lot of similarities between, like you're saying, like Morelia and these guys, because carpets are really variable. You get a lot of the same type of things, not as drastic as bloods or short tail. It's not as crazy, but you're sort of seeing the same type of thing. I think with chondros, like I said, you're breeding two together and you don't know what the hell you're going to get. And
yeah.
I got to be honest.
You don't know until they're, you know, 2 years old.
Yeah, and I got to be honest with you. It's just like I was saying at the beginning of the show, when I'm at a reptile show, I'm kind of walking around and seeing them, and they look beautiful and everything, but they are not as adults are so much more impressive. Oh my God, it's like the colors and they're really cool. A lot of cool stuff. So we got that. What about the batik? That's kind of what I equate to. Actually, this is one of the things that is another parallel with carpets. You got batik, which is kind of a crazy looking granity pixelated type of pattern, which is similar to the zebra. And if you breed a batik to a batik, you get a patternless snake. Same with if you breed a zebra to a zebra, you get a patternless snake. And they got a, don't they have a tail issue or something? Same as
I've heard that, you know, they don't survive, and I've heard a lot of rumors about super batiks. And I've only seen one adult. You know, there's just not a ton of them out there. It's a lot of blood stuff. There's just not a ton of it, so. I don't know whether there's an issue with it or not, but yeah, I mean the parallels there—it's uncanny. I mean,
one of the things with zebras and super zebras is the same thing. Like sometimes the babies just die in the egg; they just die.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't know why they just die. You know, and it's kind of crazy, but. I'm gonna send Owen this picture real quick of what a.
And then we're gonna listen to Owen's reaction of holy shit.
Yeah.
But pause for the.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we can't really pause because it's.
No, we can't. We have to keep going. Keep going. Yeah.
So yeah, you got those, and then what about some of the? I mean, like I'm thinking of. I guess these are ones that are not dialed in yet. Is like the Toba and the Black Smoke and the. Stuff like that. Is that settled on that's legit, or is that still up in the air?
It's being worked out. You know, that's most of that stuff. Tracy has all that. There's another guy that's got a Toba, so hopefully he'll get it to breed. You know, but Tracy's slowly working on all those projects and getting some of that stuff out. You know, it's just, it takes some of the, you know, acclimating wild caught stuff takes a long time, and you know, she's just going through the motions, making sure that it's done the right way, you know. So, I mean, the Borneo blood, Sumatran stuff, this is just in its infancy, really, you know, as far as projects and morphs and mutations. You know, there's so few people that even know what these snakes are, you know. When I'm at a reptile show, it's like, oh, is that a boa? Oh, yeah, that's just, look at that ball python, that's weird. It's like, are you kidding me?
The ball python hybrid. Holy hell, that thing was crazy.
Right.
Sorry, I just got that picture.
It's cool, right?
Yeah. Wow. It's pretty.
Yeah,
all right. I'm sorry. Continue. Pay no attention.
No, that's fine. I have that same reaction every time I see one. So.
Yeah. Wow.
And now you guys are just getting to where you're starting to mix, like, I think what's the one called the 007? Isn't that a Matrix and a GoldenEye? Is that? Oh, no, that's, yeah.
They look very similar to a Magpie, so it'll be interesting to see how they age and mature in comparison to what a Magpie looks like. So that'll be fun. And, you know, I've been trying to, you know, get people on board with the Matrix stuff for a long time because it kind of, you know, I'm going to get hell for this too, but it's, you know, there's a yellow belly comparison there. You know, yellow belly
okay.
and the ball python thing.
Sure.
You know, it really changes patterns and stuff. You know, what it did to a golden eye, and it's just such a subtle mutation, but it made a big difference.
Cool.
You know, so once you start working in with some of that stuff, they've done it with the bad teeth too, and it really just increases the you know, that cream color pattern, and it's just it's really cool. It's fun stuff. You know, that's all. It's just fun stuff.
That's definitely very cool. I mean, it kind of seems like everything would be. Stop sending me pictures of blood pythons, Eric. Jesus Christ, I'm trying to focus. What the hell is that? See, this is what he does, because then I sound like an idiot. So,
that's you and me, though, so.
Exactly. I mean, it's like, you know, all of a sudden it's like, I need to start thinking about what I'm going to, ooh, pretty snake, and then it's over. I'm totally lost track, and I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So, that is kind of cool. So now where did he leave off? What are some of the other really brand spanking new kind of morphs things that are working out there?
Well, you know, Matt's Borneos, the ocelots are unbelievable.
I've seen the ocelots. I've seen them. I got one. So
There you go.
Yeah, only because Matt had said hamburger and it's like three tables down from me. So, yeah, I've seen them. So, Dawn, the ocelots are still fairly new, correct?
Yeah, they're new. You know, the very few magpies out there. You know, it's a handful of people that have them. And then working some of the T-negative stuff into, you know, bad teeth and caramel, excuse me. Sorry, Bat Geek and GoldenEye, and there's some Stripe lines out there that are throwing some really neat stuff. You know, it's you know, working through it and getting people interested in it, and, you know, Tracy has a couple different lines of T-negatives, which are pretty cool. So it's just, you know, there's a bunch of stuff out there, and then there's the Caramel Albino, Orange Head Sumatran, which is a beautiful snake. And,
yeah.
yeah, I mean, that thing is just, they're amazing snakes. And they're, you know, that's it. The Orange Heads are some of my favorite bloods to work with. They're a little bit smaller. They're real laid back and mellow. They, you know, they're beautiful snakes. And then, I forgot about this, that Ben Siegel has an albino Borneo.
Really?
Yeah. Which,
so is that a T-positive or T-negative?
I think that is a T-positive.
Oh, man.
Wow.
That's a game changer, right? Isn't there a piebald?
Yeah.
I think.
Isn't there a piebald out there? Or is
there
that
is.
One of those rumors?
No, it's true. A piebald's out there. I'm not exactly sure who got it. But I did see pictures of it. It's nice.
Wow. Who cares as long as they breed it, right?
Yeah, who gives a damn as long as it gets around, yeah. Who cares where it starts? So,
yeah,
wow.
Shit. I can't even imagine a snake like that piebald. That's, oh, man. Wow.
Yeah, especially working
that's crazy.
Right into it. That's going to be great.
Well, I'm just thinking about, like, you know how you were using the analogy of the yellow belly, and I'm just thinking about the different types of ball python piebalds, And, like, when you put these little subtle genes into it and you get, like, a low white piebald and you got, like, crazy pattern. And now I'm thinking of, like, their crazy pattern already. And then when you're, oh, man, that's wild. That's going to be some great shit.
This is just starting to come into speed a little bit. And people are realizing that they're not these big behemoth, crap spewing monsters. They're great snakes. They make great pets.
I guess that's the other thing maybe we didn't hit on. And Owen, you'll probably love this idea, and maybe you can go
on
a little more. Is that they do not go to the bathroom all that often.
I have heard that.
So it's not like carpets or,
corn snakes are every other goddamn day I have to clean those bastards because they eat it and they crap it. But I've heard that blood pythons, like I said, like kind of like Gaboon vipers, will kind of hold on to the feces in their intestines longer to use it as a pivot point for when they have to throw their big-ass body at whatever it is they want to strike at.
Right.
So they're like a counterweight.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they can hit that prey item harder. That's the theory. And it's just, they're a snake that'll just sit and sit and sit and wait and wait and wait, on an animal trail. Or, they don't move around a lot, and they do not have a very fast metabolism. So that's, you get 2, 3, 4... bowel movements a year. It makes maintenance
Holy
really
crap.
Really easy. So if you're thinking about these snakes, Owen, there's a good point for you.
Damn
wow.
it. you get these goddamn corn snakes making me do work out of here and get these blood pythons that'll just be like as lazy as me. Cool. So, yeah. All right, this.
We do have a question that came in before you go into breeding, and this kind of has a lot to do with breeding, but this is from Graham Battison, and he says, this came in today, so it wasn't on the sheet, so this is a little off the wall.
Oh, man.
So Graham would like to know how you breed your bloods with regards to size and weight of females, as they seem to be very weight sensitive when it comes to producing viable eggs.
Okay. I like my females to be closer to 4 years, or at 4 years before I try and breed them. They do have a slow metabolism, so I raise mine up a little bit slower than some people do. I think having that extra, 6, 8, 12 months makes a big difference, because if you throw food at these snakes, they're going to eat it. I mean, there's no doubt. They're like a garbage disposal. But what ends up happening is you get really obese snake. And when that snake gets into breeding mode and you're starting to put a male with it and she's growing those follicles, what ends up happening is those follicles hit the fat wall and she reabsorbs them, or she'll slug out. You don't want your blood pythons to be fat. I kind of like the comparison. If you put your two index fingers together and your two thumbs together, that's kind of what the body shape should be. So you should be able to see a little bit of that spine, and then, nice and rounded at the bottom, but you don't want a snake that, like a 2-liter bottle of soda. So for me, it's 12 pounds probably, but age and raising them slow is definitely the key to, successful first clutches, and then the health of the female in, years beyond that.
Cool.
Okay.
So, obviously, you want to have them a little bit on the thinner side. Can you walk us through the entire approach that you use for breeding your bloods and your short tails, like cooling, when... Do you stop feeding altogether? Do you seasonally feed, and when do you do the introductions?
My snake room has a window in it, once the season starts to change, the snakes start to act differently. But I'll feed up my females, in the spring up until about August, and then I kind of slow down when it gets real, real hot, and then, back up until October and November when I make my introductions. And then, like I said earlier, that my ambient temperature in my snake room stays about 82. So when I first start to cool, I'll just turn the heat off altogether for, you know, it'll be 4 hours and then six and then eight. But I really let the females tell me what's going on. So you just have to really, you know, be observant once they start wrapping water bowls and kind of acting different. And I'll start making my introductions, especially after shed cycles and that kind of thing. You know, I mean, male snakes in general are pretty much good to go anytime. So it's really what your females are telling you. You know, you just want to be in tune with what's going on, you know, and just watch them. And then I usually start my season around that. It's, you know, so it could be, you know, September or it could be December. It's just kind of where they're at. And that's really the biggest factor for me. So it's, I don't, you know, let them get real cold, obviously, and always bring my temperatures back up so they can start their metabolic process and you know, stay healthy. And then I feed all breeding season.
Cool. So now when it comes to clutch sizes, what are you looking at here? How many, like, what's the biggest one you've seen, and what's about a normal average one?
Well, for reds, you end up getting a bigger egg but less eggs, and then Borneos, you end up having smaller eggs and a bigger clutch. So for reds, I usually get about 12 to 14, and then in the Borneos, I've gotten up to 24. So it's, you know, double.
Okay. So if I were to say suggest, like, maybe crossing them to get a medium-sized egg at an average amount, that would be sacrilege, correct?
Yeah, I'm not going there with you.
All right. Nobody did anything. Nobody meant it. So are they maternal mothers? Do they take care of the eggs, or do you decide that that's something they shouldn't have and take them away?
I end up pulling them.
Okay.
You know, it's just because I can control the temperature and humidity better in my own incubator than what actually goes on in the cage, you know. So I pull them, soak the females in, you know, a little bit of, or some water and a little bit of mild soap to get that smell off of them, clean their cage out, get them set up, and then offer food the next day just to get them back going. And in general, my policy is to breed my females every other year. I don't like to go back-to-back unless the females really bounce back. And then if they do go back-to-back, then they're not going 3 years, because I've heard of females actually going 3 years, and it's such a drain on them that they die. And, you know, there's no point in that.
Right. So now do you what size is normally the tub that you put the eggs in? I mean, do you break up the clutch a little bit? Are you just going to leave them in a big mound in a bigger bin?
I'll just leave them in however they kind of stick together. And I use the Iris sweater box. So it's the step up. It's a little bit bigger. And then, you know, 3 to 3.5 inches of perlite. And just, you know, just damp to the touch enough where if you squeeze it, it'll clump, but no water will run out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I incubate at about 88 degrees, and it takes, you know, 60 to 65 days for them to hatch. I like to do it a little bit. A little bit cooler, a little bit longer. Babies come out healthier and more robust. Once the first snake pips, I'll cut the rest of the clutch, but I won't cut before just to look at what's going on. You know, it's just then that, you know, a lot of times those snakes come out quicker than they were ready to.
Mm-hmm. So now, are the eggs in the substrate, or are they suspended above?
They're actually in. They have contact with the substrate.
Okay. Now, baby bloods. Normally, you know, it's like we said, normally we get chondro breeders on here who have really teeny babies that, like, are very fragile, who some of them are absolute bears to, you know, get eating. Like, I fully suspect I'm going to lose all my hair when I finally produce chondros. So, now baby bloods... Are they difficult to get started?
No, they're great. The only thing that I think people don't realize is it can take a long time for them to have their first meal. And, you know, most pythons will shed in 7 to 10 days and then start eating. Blood pythons won't shed for months. And I don't even start my feeding trials until about the third week.
Wow.
Okay.
Very, very different. You know, again, it goes into their whole metabolic rate, I think, and they're just different that way. So, and then, and I was feeding some hatchling snakes right before I got on your program here, and a whole clutch ate frozen pod right away, first meal. So,
wow. What's their first meal size wise?
I usually do small mice. I find mice
what?
To be, yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, snakes are no hassle. So yeah, I usually just use mice. Their first or second, their first and second meals, just to get them going, because I feel like mice have a stronger smell, and you get a better feeding response. But then I switch over to rats, and they take rats from then on.
Wow.
So an adult female, right, that's going into the breeding season, what are you feeding her?
Most medium rat every 10 to 14 days. But for that time where I'm feeding heavy, I'll do a large rat every 10 to 14 days. They don't require a lot of food. You know, you're talking about a 5.5, 6-foot snake just eating a medium rat every 2 weeks. You know,
okay.
Some people wonder about guinea pigs and rabbits and all this stuff, and you're just going to end up with a snake that's too big. They will do it, you know, happily, but it's, you know, they have a tendency to get pretty obese. Now, I used to see pictures of them, you know, just huge, these huge fat snakes, and it's just like, whoa, that's dope.
Yeah. Now, is it kind of like similar to, like, if you were to look at, say, a fat retic or a fat berm, to where when they're, I mean, because if you look at the snake, it's typically they're bigger, but are they going to get those rolls and everything? Is that when you're looking at an obese blood?
Pretty much, you know, it's just going to be a really, really round. I mean, you'd be able to tell the difference. It's just, yeah, like you were saying, you get that the rolls, and they're just real, even more lethargic than they already are. And it's so easy to do it because they will eat everything. So it's like, oh,
right.
Cool, you know, let's do this. But,
right.
You know, you just have to, you know, manage it because they just, you know, their metabolisms are so slow, and when you keep them at cooler temperatures, and it's just the nature of the snake.
So how often do you feed the babies if they have such slow metabolisms? I mean, normally I'm good for once a week for my little guys to try to get them a little bit bodied, get them growing a little bit before I try to sell them.
That's the same thing that I do, you know, when they're
okay.
Small. But it won't be a big meal, you know. It's just to get them going and put some size on them, get them through that first shed, and then I usually slow it down to 14, 21 days even.
Now, when they're first hatching and you're setting them up, are you keeping them damp until they shed, or are you just, you know, straight in, just like you would keep an adult?
Yeah, just the same. You know, a lot of times they'll knock their water bowls over throughout the week, so they're staying humid enough. And that's all, you know. I mean, if I notice they're starting to dry out, I'll just spray them down with a little bit of water. But, you know, they knock their water bowls over constantly. So, you know,
really?
They kind of handle it. Yeah, they handle that on their own. I mean, they're, you know,
okay.
Like a lot of snakes, they're pretty messy.
Gotcha. So what are you talking, like a 16-ounce deli cup as a water bowl for what you're setting up?
For those little guys, I just use one of those, like, souffle cups. They're pretty
tiny, okay.
The little disposable ones. Just set those up and throw them out, and I can just go cage by cage and change them out and not have to scrub water bowls.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. Very cool. I was going to say about I've often heard that sex in these guys when they're young is kind of difficult. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, initially it can be because the females have really large scent glands. But if you're going through a whole clutch, it can be really easy to tell. The males, their hemipenes kind of curve out away from their body. They're larger and bright, bright red. But those scent glands are going to be smaller. Shoot straight up, and they might have a red tip, but the whole thing won't be red. So it can be like, oh, wow, it's like my whole clutch is males. What am I going to do? But But there is a difference, and once you start doing more, it becomes kind of obvious.
Gotcha. Okay. I guess the other thing, I as Owen was talking to you, I was sending him pictures from your Facebook page. I was just clicking away and sending them all kinds of
stuff. I know. This is what you do when you're quiet. When you're really quiet, I know you're up to something. So, you know, it's like, what's he doing? All of a sudden, like, bing, bing, bing. I'm like, that's awesome. That's awesome. Like, dude, stop it. I got a, you know, house, mortgage, knock it off, all right? No more. Christ.
So I thought we would talk about your what you had going on this season, maybe what you have going on next season. One of the things that I've been waiting for this forever, and then finally, I don't know, I sent you a message yesterday, you snooze, you lose, but your Sumatrans, oh man, mm-hmm. they're as black, and they're all gone, and I was like, damn it! But, man, they're gorgeous animals. I didn't think that they were as popular as the other ones, but I guess I was wrong. So tell us a little bit about that pairing.
Well, I picked up that, the female from Kara and Ryan. They did they name all their snakes. So the clutch that they did was Jackson and Pitch Breeding, and the results were unbelievable. Every snake from that clutch is just like, I mean, they're so dark and just real dark heads and nice orange eyes. They're just beautiful. So I was lucky enough to pick up a snake like that. And then the male I produced from a nice real dark male and a chrome head that I also picked up some years ago from Kara. If you guys can't tell, we're pretty good friends. So that clutch resulted in a lot of really nice dark babies and no chromes. So that, you know, whether I just, you know, luck of the draw or you know, the genetics just weren't there for it, but they were all nice dark heads. But I'll be doing that pairing again this coming year, so I'll put you down for that.
Okay, good. Because, man, they're just incredible.
They're dark as hell.
I know, I'm like really late to this picnic, all right? I mean, it's like you guys already know what the hell's going on here. And then it's like, what are they talking about? Holy crap, they're talking about that. So, you know, it's Jesus.
It's just one of those things that it's like I try to, you know, do the best pairing that I can. So, you know, I like the lineage stuff. I know a lot of Morelia people do, too. It's, you know, what were the parents and all that kind of stuff. I think it's interesting. And it, you know, it gives you a guideline to go on for future pairings and projects and stuff, you know, so it's not just like throwing stuff together. There's actually a purpose and a plan.
A rhyme or a reason, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of the things that also attracts me to the Bloods and the Short Tails, and just the community is that type of thing. I see that a lot, mm-hmm. which is cool. Lineage is very cool.
Yeah, and people do a good job with it, and it's just kind of, it's nice to have and to know.
Absolutely. So, in case you want to follow along and you're listening, you can go over to Cold Blooded Earth, his Facebook page, and give it a like, and you can see exactly what we're talking about. And I'm trying to navigate through the pairings here, but I guess this one is a granite super stripe to granite super stripe. This is the one that threw those crazy babies.
Yeah, that's the pairing that threw that. You know, I produced those, like I said earlier, from doing a stripe, a blonde super stripe that had a little bit of fleckling on it to a fade, which is just, you know, without getting back into the Borneo conversation, which is just a visible head for latte. So those are what ended up coming out. And I kept two back and raised them up and finally was able to breed them this past winter, and oh man, I was excited about that. I love them. They came out better than I could have imagined.
Oh yeah. I'm with you there. They're pretty crazy. Let's see. I'm trying to see if I can find that picture. Now you had is that another Borneo pairing that you had? Where I guess it's that's the blonde super stripe and the ultra bright.
Yeah,
that's a nice one too.
That female is the sibling to that dark redhead animal I was talking about earlier. So there's, you know, that they're siblings, but they look nothing alike except that they have a stripe. So did that to that ultra bright and produced some pretty wild stuff. Again, there's some stuff with some granite fleckling in it, and there's some really nice stuff and some dark super stripes with a nice orange head. So some of those babies are going to be really, really nice.
Cool.
Okay.
Yes, I'm talking about these things brought by two on Saturday, so, you know. This is bad. I mean, eat everything. It's calm, and I don't need to clean it. Shit.
So, what would you ask for?
Oh, God.
So what did you do with your Goldeneye? What did you breed that to this year?
The Goldeneye this year, he was a stud. I did Goldeneye to Ivory. So I ended up getting those 007s. And then I did Goldeneye to Albino, and then Goldeneye to just a nice normal red.
Okay.
Sweet.
So kind of, you know, offers a few different options, you know. If you haven't seen the Albino Golden Eyes, they're just, I mean, Matt Turner has some beautiful stuff.
I haven't seen it. Might have to pick it up.
Yeah, they're incredible. They take it to another level, if you can believe it.
Okay. real quick,
you don't sound
before
like you believe me.
I'm gonna look it up and find.
we gotta stall for time so we can get that.
Yeah.
So.
Real quick though, I do have a question.
We just had an
email come in, and the question is from Jeremy Nate. He says, "Hello, I was super excited to hear of another blood short tail python episode. I have two questions for Nick, which I will try to keep brief."
Excellent, because now we can stall for time while Eric looks for other pictures.
Yes.
Go.
What is the blood python community like? One of the things I've realized is I really like about the Morelia isn't just the snakes themselves, but the caliber of people in the Morelia family and the chondro community as well. I like ball pythons, but there are some ball python folks I'm not fond of. I think we all know the kind of people I mean. What is the scene for blood pythons like? And then his other question was, another aspect of Morelia I really like is all the scientific stuff, specifically researching their ecology, et cetera. Do you know some good books or articles to read for researching bloods and short tails?
All right. I'll take the first question. I like that about the Morelia community too. You know, the people that were in it were always really great and helpful, when I have those kind of snakes. And it's the same thing in our community. It's very tight-knit. People are willing to share and help. Nobody's going to yell at you or judge you. Everybody's just here to learn. And that's, another thing that really attracted me to it. And I've met some, lifelong friends in this community. You know, we don't get to see each other, obviously, because people are spread out, all over the place. But, having something in common and a passion for it, it brings people together, and it's a really good group of people. So, we'll welcome you with open arms for sure.
Very cool. And
right.
Is there any books or articles or anything that he can research these guys?
There's nothing, no books yet. I know that it might be in the works, but if you look up, VPI or bloodpythons.com, they have a ton of information and lots of pictures and just, you know, everything you would need for husbandry and that kind of stuff. So that's two good places to go, and hopefully one day we'll see that boat.
Yeah, that would be the, I guess that would be what, the third Pythons of the World 3? Is that where it's geared towards?
I think so. But, you know, I have to ask for that.
Yeah. I mean, to, in the Morelia world, the volume one is kind of, you know, that's kind of like the Bible of Bibles. That, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. That book is, that book, both of them, even, you know, I know the other ones on Ball Pythons, but, I mean, it's still, it's just incredibly well done, you know. And it's, you know, hopefully it'll happen for the Bloods, and it'll, you know, that would be really good for the species as a whole, you know.
Yeah. Well, I Googled albino goldeneye, and God damn. Wow.
Next level, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
God damn, that's cool. Wow.
So hopefully, you know, next few years, maybe we'll get there, you know?
Very cool. Very, very cool.
Crazy.
I can't stop staring at it, man.
Cool. Okay. Focus.
Yeah.
Get through the show, and then you can Google.
That is, I got to say that part of the excitement for me is the chase, if that makes sense. Like, so when I first got into carpets, it was kind of the chase of trying to figure out what all these things were and everything. And I find myself in that same boat now with the Bloods and the short tails. It's kind of like, you know, researching to try to find out about them and what this is and what that is and what's the different line, and try to get up to the level to where, you know, you guys in the community are. And part of the fun of that is learning, because I think for me, one of the things that I've learned about myself this year is that if you, although I do like to be focused on what I'm doing, I do find that sometimes when you are focused, that you kind of, you box yourself into a world and you can't think outside of that box, at least for me personally.
Right.
So when I'm working
right.
with other types of species, especially just other pythons, and you listen to other communities and their approach to different things, you know, whether it's anything from husbandry to breeding to, you know, just how genetics work, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, say what you will about ball pythons and whatnot, but again, these guys got genetics kind of locked in that they can look at a snake and say, oh yeah, that little blotch there is going to, you know, do this. I see it similar in the Bloods. I don't know how you pick out markers for whatever, but I would assume that you guys have, I don't know if I can use this word in your community, but the Dinker projects, is that?
How dare you, sir?
All right. Well, I mean, you know, with the Bloods, everything could be Dinker. You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's, you know, they're like, again, the amount of variability, I mean, you could just take it. So it's kind of, I mean, that's, for me, kind of like a slippery slope. It's like, I mean, does it just, you know, when is it too far? You know, when is it just like, you know, a pattern variation? And yeah, I mean, it's genetic, but it's not, you know, it's not the
sure.
next golden eye. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, so I mean, there might be stuff that ends up coming out like that. You know, it's just kind of, it's tough because, you know, every little thing could be taken that way. And it's just, you know, it's just the snake being the snake.
Gotcha. Right. Because the variability is so crazy. It's kind of, yeah, it's, man, that makes it difficult, though, because what if you're missing out on some kind of cool, crazy, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
You just don't call a Dinker project out in public, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. You don't talk about it.
You keep that down low. All right, I got it.
You know, more of my focus is just, you know, using the right females and the right pairings, you know, for the stuff that I'm working with. You know, that's, for me, that's it. It's, you know, when I'm walking around the show, first of all, there's just not a whole lot of Bloods or stuff out there where you could be like, oh, that's cool, you know, like, that's cool. You know, because some of it, like, there's what they call a blonde, and it's in the red blood family, and it's it's a little color and pattern mutation, and sometimes it's genetic, and a lot of times it's not. So it's just the variability factor.
Right. Oh, mm-hmm. Right. So, do you have a? All right. Let's take the Matrix for example. Okay. So you have mm-hmm. a Matrix, and you want to make an ivory. Is there things that you should be looking for with the Matrix to make a better ivory? Is there what would you be looking for in that?
Nah, man. That's a good question. That's a tough question. You know, because you end up taking two snakes that are basically, red bloods, and then you end up with a white snake with a gray stripe down its back. So, I haven't produced enough to be able to make that call. With Matrix, again, some of them are barely noticeable, and then some of them are really intense color and pattern, and they're obvious. And some people aren't big fans of the ones that are real subtle. They want, to be able to be like, yeah, that's it right there. I haven't produced enough. I've only probably produced three or four of them. So it's hard for me to say whether or not that it would produce a better super form.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I mean, if it follows the pattern of what, a lot of blood python stuff does, if you're going to use two really nice red matrix, that you would end up with a nice clean ivory.
Okay. All right. So just so our listeners would know, what exactly are the what is the phenotype for a matrix? Like, what are you looking at? What are you seeing on this animal? It's color and pattern?
It's more, pattern. You're going to look for the stripe behind its eye.
Okay.
It's going to be a little bit wider than it would be in a normal. They're going to have a pink tongue. There's going to be some pixelation of the belly scales. They're not going to be real nice, neat, and clean. And then there'll be some pattern variations on the dorsal, so it'll be a little bit busier looking in general than a normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But it's something that, on my Facebook page, I've done a comparison photo album of both, matrix next to normals, because it's easier to see than it is to describe, because it can be very, very subtle.
Gotcha. Didn't you do, wasn't there a picture that you had where you had matrix with a morph, and showing,
mm-hmm.
wasn't there like three different snakes you had together? And
yeah, I did. The picture of the golden eye and then matrix and then the 007, just to show what adding something so simple can do. It's really amazing.
So the one with the, so I can tell that's the 007, the one that's kind of looks like the matrix but is whiter in the inside or the base pattern. Is that?
Yeah, so if you're looking at that photo, you have the three snakes. So you have the golden eyes on the bottom, the 007's in the middle, and the matrix is on the top. So you can see what the matrix did to the golden eye was to lift out a lot of that red in pattern and fill it in.
Gotcha. I found your I also found your picture of the comparison between. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. Absolutely. Because I gotta be honest, when I was first looking at them, it was hard for me to tell what was a normal blood python and what wasn't. It was kinda...
It's a question that comes up a lot, and it is hard to describe, and it's a lot easier to
see. Okay, very cool. I might as well share this one too. The Owen, be paying attention on the Facebook page,
because
here it comes.
I'm waiting in bated breath.
You see it now?
My computer's
slow. Wow. You got to get rid of dial up, man.
I do not have dial up. I am here. Jesus. Holy hell, that's awesome.
Yeah. That's, I guess you were excited when they popped out.
Oh, man. I'm so happy with the way they look. And I just can't wait to see what they look like in 3 years, you know. And it's gonna be fun because, you know, I mean, there's a lot of white snakes out there, but with the blood, they just don't stay white, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of like the I don't know what this one that you – I think this is from your – wait, let me see if I get this pairing right. It's the one that has the – it's a stripe, kind of looks striped. I guess it's a red, but it's got a real wide stripe down the back. I think you were waiting for the eggs to hatch still from this pairing.
Oh, yeah, that was that's a stripe line hypo, that female. It's kind of orange.
Yes.
Okay,
that is
so, yeah, I did that snake to my founding stripe line male. So I got this male about 5 years ago, that real dark, like real red snake that should be follow that photo of the hypo. So I did that, and that clutch should be hatching in about a week here, so the resulting offspring, hopefully, you know, should be, all be striped, and then 100% head hypo.
Okay. So let me ask you this. With those, why did you go with the darker snake? Were you hoping for the hypo to be brighter because you have that? Go ahead. Sorry.
With that pairing, it was, one, I really wanted to outcross some stripe lines. And then I did want to incorporate the hypo into a darker snake to see what it would do in the following generation, to see what, you know, what the results would be of adding hypo into potentially very dark snakes and just seeing what would happen. So I'm pretty excited about it.
I think that the genetics would probably work the same way. Owen did a pairing with a caramel to a darker snake, and I remember when caramels first came out, like caramel is kind of not really a true hypo, but in the same line, I guess, for carpet pythons. And he bred that one to a darker snake. And then there was, at the same time, the people, you know, the community was kind of like, no, you should breed it to ones that are thin black bands. The less black, the better, because it's kind of like your...
Bright colors,
the
bright
genes are kind of,
yeah.
Right, kind of pulling it away. But I got to be honest, the caramel that I got from Owen is nicer, far nicer than
any
of the caramels.
Stop rubbing it in, all right? The fact that I'll just walk away with that thing.
From any of the other things. So I think that you might be onto something there. I think you're going to see.
Yeah.
That's a clutch that I'm going to be watching for sure because, number one, it's striped, and I love anything striped. And that female is just incredible. Man.
She's real deep. I'm with you. I love striped stuff. So I just was like, you know, diversify the bloodlines a little bit and play around with some colors, you know.
Yeah. Wow. So what do you got cooking for next year? Like, what's your big project that you're most excited about this coming year?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I do want to produce a couple more albino ivories.
Okay.
I'd like to work T negative into my stripe line. I'd like to get that going. And then, let's see, I definitely would like to produce some more 007s, maybe head albinos. I think that I'll keep moving forward with that. I'll probably have a year a little bit slower than this year, just because I'm going to give my females some breaks. And then, you know, just more golden eyes, I think I'd like to do. I'm going to do that granite super stripe pairing again and the black blood clutch again. So, you know, there's definitely some stuff in the works and I'm just trying to keep moving forward and, you know, making cool snakes.
Yeah, I think for me next year, this year, a goal of mine was to pick up at least a female from all three of the species.
Right.
Next year, I think my goal is going to be to pick up a golden eye.
Well, I know where you can get one, so you just let me know.
Yeah, yo.
Yeah. I remember way back when Reptile Radio was going strong, and they must have had Tracy coming on the show or something, and she came on and she was talking about the different stuff. And when they first released that snake, that was, oh my God. I was like, God damn. And then when they released the Super, I was like, holy shit. Are you serious? Wow.
I know. I mean, you can't picture that stuff, you know? You just, it's unbelievable to just be able to open up that rack and see snakes that look like that. I mean, it's just like, I'm blown away all the time.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's always been something, even when, you know, I've always wanted to work with that. So that's a goal for me for next year. But, yeah, it sounds like some awesome stuff. I mean, anybody can go over and check. I can't do it justice talking about it. You have to go over to the Facebook page, Cold Blooded Earth, and check it out and see all the different things that he has going on. Because I mean, you just flip through the pictures the whole time you guys were talking. I just kept going through again and again and again. Wow, that's pretty cool. Awesome stuff. Let's see. Anything else? I mean, I guess my other question would be. What's the blood python market like? How is it? Are they starting to become more popular? Is it, what's your feel, your take on it?
Absolutely, they're definitely starting to pick up some momentum. You know, I think that the community as a whole has done a good job to promote the species and educate people and show them that they're not, you know, what people think of, you know, when they hear blood pythons, which 20 years ago, wild caught imports and just insane, you know. And of course, I mean, you know, if you got yanked from your home, you'd be the same way. So it's really come a long way, and, you know, it's just getting the word out. It's getting the word out because people have a misconception about them that, you know, they get respiratory infections and they have to be kept really hot and wet and, you know, they're mean, you can't handle them, and they're hard to breed, and it's just, you know, the captive market has really done a lot for the snake. You know, it's come a long way, and it's really starting to pick up some steam, especially, you know, with some of the laws coming down the pipes and that stuff. I think it offers people, again, that big snake feel without having to have a burn or a retic. You know, you still get a big snake that you can, you know, show off and really enjoy.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think, you know, Morelia Python Radio, even though we're called Morelia Python Radio, really one of our focuses when we first started the show was to try to take some of the species of python that are kind of underrated or what the misconceptions are about them. And, you know, way back in the day, people thought they were this way. They called them blood pythons because they drew blood or carpets, you know. You know what I mean? They have the same type of thing.
Right.
You know, and it's kind of, that's kind of the idea. The whole thing is just to educate people about, you know, what they're about. And let's be real. All pythons taken from the wild are not really the tamest, you know. I mean,
yeah. not at all, you know.
Yeah,
and I think, you know, what you guys are doing is great because it's just, yeah, there's not just ball pythons out there, and not all carpet pythons want to bite your face, and it's just kind of, you know, it's just getting the word out. It's getting the word out.
Yeah.
If you do go to a reptile show, you're limited, especially like Robin was talking about earlier, the local ones. It's just, you're limited in the vendors, so you're going to see a lot of stuff. It's either wild card or you get ball pythons. And that's kind of all you're left with.
Right.
So, you know, being able to get the word out that there are other things out there and stuff, you know, that suits anybody, you know.
Right. What's your take on reptile auctions? Just curious.
I'm with you guys. You know, it's not my cup of tea at all. I won't do it. But you know, like you guys were saying, there's a marketplace for it, so somebody is going to fill it. You know, whether we like it or not, but it's you know, I mean, the internet has changed everything for reptiles. I mean, sales and reptile shows, and it's just, I think, the next, you know, the next difference.
Okay. I guess my other question would be, I have two questions left, but one would be, how is the stability of, like, some of the higher-end stuff? Does it seem to be holding its value, or is it, you know, how is the blood python community when it comes to that type of stuff?
In general, really good.
Right.
You know, with the T-negative thing, that market got tanked. But, you know, at first I was like, oh, man, this is awful now. You know, this is going to be, you know, the next wave of the crash and the whole thing. But, it, you know, not all T-negs are created equal. So I think that even though they came down like that, one, it allows people to work with them. And then it also gives people the opportunity to spend the time to breed them like T-positives have been done for the last, you know, 15 years. It's really make them the best example that they can. And if you're cranking them out, you're not doing that. So it gives you a different outlet where you don't really have to worry about it as much, because you can do the work to make, you know, that snake better. You know, for example, I mean, you can get a teen egg for, you know, $500 or $600. But I sold some head teen eggs this year for about that. So it's really, you know, your choice once you pick that snake up where you want to move with the project, because, you know, just because that happened doesn't mean you're going to have the best T-negative in the world because you picked one up. You know, I think that if you approach it that way and you put the work into it, you're going to see some really cool T-negative stuff.
Right. So one of the things that, again, as I delve into the world of bloods and short tails, and I wish that some carpet people do this, most do not. One is based off of lineage. So, mm-hmm. for example, with them being so variable, just like you were just saying, you know, if you're going by a lower end example of a certain morph or maybe a line, mm-hmm. you're going to get what you pay for, and the results later on down the line, you're going to say, "Damn it, I wish I would have did so and so."
Yeah,
but
you spend extra.
Yeah,
you know.
But the thing that I notice, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but this is my perception of what I see is, and maybe I'm just looking at the right people, that it doesn't seem like you guys budge on price. It is what it is. You know what I mean? And if you're stuck with the snake, you don't really give a shit. And that's what it is.
That's exactly right. I think for a lot of people, it's that. I mean, one, there's not a ton of it out there, right? So if, you know, if that's the price, and you know, it's not a bad thing to raise that snake up for another year or two, because you're not going to get the full effect of it right now. So it's kind of like, well, I'll just hang on to it then, and, you know, in 2 years it's going to be awesome, so yeah, screw you. You know, it's like,
right.
That's kind of, you know, the mindset of a lot of people, and, you know, the people that have put that work into it and the time know that what their animals are worth, and really, in the grand scheme of things, none of it in the blood python world is unreasonable. You know, there's 10, $15,000. It's not like that, because it's just there's not the demand for it like that. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
But even still, I think that I think when you do that, whatever type of reptile you're working with, I think you send a message to your customer that your stuff is valuable. I think I know that sounds crazy. But
right.
Like, you would think that a customer would want you to to drop the price, but at the same time, it kind of, I don't know, again, this is just my perception, but when I look into the world and knowing what I know from the Morelia world, it's kind of like, oh, man, these guys really value their stuff, and that's that. You know what I mean? If you don't want it, then you don't want it.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the customer buying it long-term then has, you know, that potential going forward, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
And that matters, you know, because there is a cost built in, but that it does matter to people. You know, it's one of those things, you know, that Greg Maxwell wrote in one of his Condro books about, you know, you wouldn't walk into a Mercedes dealership and want to get, you know, a Kia. It's just kind of like...
Right.
It's just, but you know, I mean, you know, that sent people into a tizzy, but it's true. It's like you do get what you pay for, and you know, people do put a lot of work into their stuff, and I know you guys do, and it's kind of like, you know, I'll just hang on to it because it, you know, it has a value to me, and you know, I'm moving a ton of animals. You know, all my projects are real precise and thought out, so it's kind of like if I keep it, then I hang on to it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and
right.
If it's a male, potentially, before it sells, you know, my boys, once they hit 18 months, if they're still hanging around here, I might find one of my girls to breed him to and then sell him as a proven male and then add value to him and, you know, I got some new blood kicking around. So.
Exactly. You know, and it like we were talking about, you guys were talking about with the auction stuff. It's like thinking about that and not panicking when stuff starts to slow down.
Right.
You know, I think that you just kind of got to just, you know, hang in and not, you know, be like, oh, my God, you know, it's going to be okay.
We're never going to sell.
20% off. 20% off.
You know, like
50%
after trying to sell it for an hour, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, mind you, that nobody takes the time to put the, you know, the promotion into you know what I mean? I think that sometimes people have this false dream, I guess, and they think that, like, you know, oh, I'm going to buy this snake and I'm going to breed it and, you know, 2 years from now, everybody's going
to
they're going to be knocking at my door for this snake and they're going to be like, oh, man, I want to spend $5,000 with you and, you know, they don't even know who you are.
They breed it. When they read it, they're like, who the hell are you, and why should I buy from you? And you don't have enough answers.
But,
so,
I mean, it takes a lot of work. I mean, you guys know it. It takes a long time. It's not, there is no way to do this quick. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to break even, then, you know, you've put the time in. So, it's, you know, that's kind of, the way I view that, it's just, you know, you gotta put the time in. You're not gonna get rich overnight. This isn't, you know, like an oil boom, you know.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that's cool. That's a cool thing that I noticed. So, I guess my other question would be, so we have all these people out there listening now that have their carpet pythons and their chondros and their scrubs and they're like. Because our passion is flowing tonight for blood pythons, now they want to get into blood pythons.
Which I appreciate.
What would be the one thing, the best tip you could give that person that wants to get into blood?
Yes.
Be patient with your animal. That's what I think that's the best advice, just to be patient with it. You know, people get discouraged really quick. You know, they're different. So, you know, let them settle in. Don't mess with them right away. They seem buddy. Just, you know, you have to build a relationship with them where they know that you're not going to hurt them. Take your time. Go slow. I think it's just really just be patient.
Okay. Cool. Very cool. All right. Now Owen has his favorite questions that he's going to ask you.
He does the crazy question.
Should I be scared?
Yes, terrified. Well, these are actually the only questions that Eric keeps me around to ask. I'm so replaceable. Anyway, the question is, if you could work with any species without limitations on space, money, time, legality, what would it be and why?
Would it have to be a snake?
No.
Big saltwater crocodile.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Wow. Was,
that's the first time.
You know, they're the size of like a van, right? I mean, wow.
You know, what big salty would be. I mean, you know, for my day job, I'm fortunate enough to be a herpetologist here at Riverbank Zoo, so I have a little croc experience, but, you know.
Okay, you're not, okay. I feel better now. It's not just like, you know. I just think they're cool. Oh, my God. All right.
The 16-year-old kid buying a Nile croc at the reptile show.
Ah, that happened in front of me. Nearly shot my, nearly blew my brains out. But, all right. So salties, and you just find them really cool.
Yeah, I think crocodilians and cool are in general are cool. You know, we do some training at work. It's basically, you know, reward system. So give them a command, click, feed, kind of stuff. Then they remember. It's cool.
Sweet. That's cool. So then the next one is, if you could travel anywhere in the world without limitations, where would it be and why?
I'd like to go Sumatra to see Blood in the Wild.
See, that's refreshing, because normally we hear Australia to see Morelia in the wild, but now it's Sumatra to see the Blood in the Wild. It makes sense. You know, I want to go see what I like in the wild. Yeah, I can buy that.
It would be cool. It would be cool.
Sweet. All right. So why don't you tell us your contact info? How do people get in touch with you? What's your website, your email, your Facebook, all that fun stuff?
Okay. Well, the Facebook page is at Cold-Blooded Earth, and then my website is cold-bloodedearth.com, and my email is nickbotini@cold-bloodedearth.com.
Awesome. So people see something they like, they just get in contact with you, and you'll get them set up with a big, fat baby blood.
Oh, yeah, we'll take care of you, and, you know, I stick around after the sale if you have any questions or need anything. That's just kind of the deal. Like I said, always willing to teach people and learn, love talking shop. So, you know, if you just want to talk bloods or whatever you want to do, that's cool, too.
Sweet.
Or snakes in general. I mean, you know, it's...
I know, that's how it, like, you know, how do you think we ran over with Robin? I mean, you're talking to the right people. We just, once it starts, it kind of just, it rolls, and they didn't realize we've been talking for 2 hours. So,
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great opportunity to be here, and I was, you know, definitely a little nervous at first, but this is, you guys are cool, so...
Thank you. We do try to take the edge off.
Once you start talking snakes, that's it, man. So.
I mean, our first couple episodes were horrible. So, yeah, we took the edge off. We had to get to ourselves. So.
You want something. You know, the very first show I did, imagine talking to yourself.
I know, because that was the first conversation you and I had. Where it's like, I really need a co-host, because I tried talking to myself, and it was a lot of silence. I'm like, wow.
You think it would be easy, but I'll tell you what, everybody go into their, like, their bathroom or their closet or something and just spend, like, 5 minutes talking to yourself and try to
just
keep, like,
talking.
Conversation and, like, it's hard to do. It sounds easy, you know, like, but no.
Oh, yeah.
Not, you know? But.
Well, Owen, we're going to get you set up this year with some blood, so don't worry about that.
No, God, no.
Well,
I promise I won't fight too hard.
Hold on, I'm going to mark this date down. Today is July 29th, and if you go back into the archives of Python Radio, way back when Owen only had a coastal carpet python.
I had a couple coastal carpet pythons, sir.
All right, he only worked with coastal carpet pythons. And
Thank you.
The episodes, he said, I will never work with anything like a scrub.
I'll probably just keep the
coastal,
yeah.
I'll just stay with this because this is what works. And then he started getting into scrubs. Now he's got white lips. Then he would say for the longest time that he's never going to get into chondros. Meanwhile, he has a very nice pair of chondros sitting in his place. So
well, because the conjure breeders took it as like a personal affront and like made it their life's mission to make me get into that by showing me pretty pictures and then Buddy doing the whole this one's for free. So, you know.
Well, maybe you should just say from now on that you're actually going to get them and then you don't have to worry about it.
Exactly. I'll get them eventually and then people leave me alone.
I decided to take Owen with me on a trip this Friday to go and see Matt Minatola's setup. And he's going to be done.
You're done.
I'm going to leave my wallet here.
Very cool. All right, Nick. Well, appreciate you coming on and spending some time with us and talking to us about Bloods and Short Tails. And, you know, anytime, I guess, next year when you're, you know, when you're hatching out some more crazy stuff, you're always welcome back. Who knows? Maybe we'll even have a Blood Python roundtable at some point where we get, every once in a while, we get a group of people and we just kind of, you know, like breeders and have them talk to, we all talk to each other about certain topics and, you know, that's usually a cool thing. So, you know, if you're up for that.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be awesome. And I really appreciate the opportunity, guys. It was nice of you to reach out and have me on.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Thank you for coming, man.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
All right. Have a good night.
All right. We'll catch up with you soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. So there we go.
That was another successful show, and yes, it was, Eric. I think I enjoyed it thoroughly. See, I just skipped that part right now, and we can move on to something else. So.
You jerk.
I'm sorry.
Don't be mad because you're...
I'm sorry. I don't want to take it from you. I'm sorry. So
don't be like a little kid that, you know, somebody stole your ball in the schoolyard. And you...
Yeah, I'm going home, taking my normal python, leaving.
He wants me not to have Morelia anymore.
We're not going to be Morelia python radio anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever the hell the scientific name is, I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. They might be changing it, so.
I just shouldn't even try learning. Okay, so.
Yeah. Morelia Python Radio is an idea. It's not about
a species. We shall stay. Yeah.
It's an idea. It's an idea of putting the animals that, you know, are kind of like overlooked, forgotten about, you know, people misunderstand and putting them out there so that people get an idea that they're not what they seem to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like Maclots, for example. Maclots pythons are
like Maclots.
God damn, they're cool.
They are cool. And you're going to enjoy them thoroughly as they get bigger.
Yes. If you have carpet pythons, I don't understand why you wouldn't have a pair of Maclots pythons. Because they're such a beautiful... they got like gold flecks in them and...
They
what
do, and they have the solid head, and they got the nice, sleek body, and they're going to start growing up really pretty. I mean, you're going to love watching them change, because baby Macs are kind of just like baby carpets. They're grayish, and then they start getting prettier and prettier and prettier. And then by the time they turn two, they're going to be fantastic looking.
Yeah.
And they're always going to keep changing. Mine always look different. Both my adults are in shed right now. I'm looking forward to when they shed, because Glitch always looks pretty when he sheds. So
yeah, I remember going
there. So
yeah, I remember going. I said this story before a long time ago. I went to a pet shop that was around the corner from me, and I walked in, and I've never seen an adult's Maclots python before. And I remember looking in the cage, and I'm like, "Wow, that is really badass," you know.
Yeah.
And I immediately went and bought one from Nick Mutton, and sure enough, that's the one that you got now.
You know, it's funny because I had never had interactions with the Max before. I had heard of them as like in, I remember seeing a Jaglot
at one of the Hamburg shows, which is a jaguar mechlot. And I remember saying that this is the most horrific creature on the planet because it looks like a normal coastal, and I wanted to just, you know, scream. But the first time you called me and you're like, I need to come over and drop off my eggs. Oh, and I was thinking about, do you want this Macaws python? And I'm like, what the hell's a Macaws python? Why do I know this word? I should know it, but I don't. And you're like, oh, yeah, I was figuring out how to try to just give it to you anyway because I don't want it. I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. And that night when you brought him over, that was the first interaction I really had with Max, was with Glitch. And just instantaneous, holy crap, this thing is awesome. So Max are cool. You know, and then, you know, we love the Liasis over here because I'm finally going to pair up my water python on Saturday, and then I just got a new pair of baby Savus as a gift from my friend Andrew. So got them to keep checking the boxes. So each one is distinct, cool, and different. So I love them all.
Yeah, it's cool stuff. So, yeah, I was telling Nick yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Nick, not Nick Mutton. I know when
not
we
Nick
always
Mutton.
Talk about Nick.
Yeah. Normally we refer to Nick
isn't
as
that
Nick
weird?
Mutton.
Yeah, isn't
it
that
is
weird how...
Because we know other people Nick. Named Nick, but...
Yeah. All my contacts for pythons are going to be Nicks in different communities.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The best way to get Eric into a new project is be named Nick. He'll automatically trust you.
Yeah. So...
That's weird.
I did pick up a few things from him, and I told him that this is going to be bad for me, but very good for you. See, the difference with me and you, Owen, is I embrace
yes.
it.
You do.
I don't try to fight it. I just say, take me.
You embrace it. I attempt to fight it as fast as much as I can, and then eventually give in.
Yeah.
Normally what ends up happening is you have hey, I have this mail that I don't need anymore. Would you like it? It's like how I fought very hard for the not having an Integrate. And then you're like, hey, you like granite jackets, don't you? And I'm like, they're very pretty. And you're like, how about a jacket granite? And I'm like, no. All right, I'll take it. So, you know, it's you're as much of a damn gateway person as Buddy is. So.
Yeah. This is true. It's the cool thing. You know, I like doing that because I think that's fun. You get people into. I'm going to do that with Matt Minutola. He's
oh, you're
going to
drag him into Morelia, kicking and screaming.
Oh yeah, because he's,
oh good.
We've
that'll
been
be fun.
Talking about carpets and all this kind of stuff, and he's hooked me up with some stuff. So he's going to get a carpet python gift. I just have to figure out the right one, and he'll be hooked. But
well,
he
won't.
Be the right
hopefully, he's not listening because then he won't be surprised.
Well, he might be,
yeah,
but
well,
still, even still, you knew you were going to get the Condro from Buddy. You knew it was coming.
Yeah, that's true. And then it's much different when you get it in your hands. So
yeah,
you know. It's like when you get that new snake and it comes in the box and you're like, I know what's in here, and then you open it and you're like, holy crap, it's awesome. So
yeah. That's an exciting time, isn't it? Blood Python wise, maybe we should let the listeners decide. Do you enjoy these shows? I know I got a lot of good feedback about, you know, doing blood shows, enough so that I traced down track down Kara from the Blood Cell, which is bloodpythons.com, and she's going to be coming on at some point to talk about bloods.
Awesome.
I think the ultimate one would be Tracy Barker. She's like a white whale for me. I'd love to get her on the
that
show.
That is no reflection on Tracy or anything like that. Jesus Christ, you can't call women white whales. Anyway.
I know, but think about it.
I know. It would be the ultimate thing to have the Barkers on. If the viewers are out there, the listeners are out there, and they want to have an episode on an animal, on a certain specific type, let us know. We'll try to find somebody who works with that animal. If you know someone who does, if you yourself work with an animal that we have not yet covered, let us know. We're pretty much open to a lot over here. We're not very picky. So
yeah.
Definitely
like
let us know, and we'll try to work it out.
Yeah, I like to try to keep it Python oriented, or at least somebody that kind of deals with pythons and other stuff. That's always fun. But the one that I get a lot is scrub pythons. But it's so hard to find people that that are working with scrub. I mean, a lot of them we've already had on, and it's there's not a lot of stuff that they can share some more. It's kind of like. I don't know. We'd have to go in the route of I know one of them that I'm trying to get is Daniel Natouche, and he agreed to do it. It's just a matter of figuring out
scheduling.
But he works with King Horneye in the wild, and he's been on GTP Keeper Radio, but he was on talking about chondros. We're going to have him on talking about scrubs and carpets. Because that's what he deals with, really, what his research is currently working with. So look forward to that episode at some point.
At a later date.
I guess the one thing that I will mention is that we now have a Morelia Python Radio store.
Oh, my God. Right. Yeah, I forgot we were going to mention that today.
Yeah.
So.
It's up and going, and more items will be added as we go along. Right now, we just have basically shirts from some of the previous boosters that we did. If maybe you missed out on one of those shirts and you'd like to get one, you can go over to MoreliaPythonRadio.com and pick one up. Also, right now, there is I like to drink a cup of coffee before I do the show. And I have it in my Morelia Python Radio coffee mug. Owen likes to chug a beer. And he
chug a beer before the show. So I have it in my frothy, nice, Morelia Python Radio beer stein. Anyway, there's so much stuff. And if you guys have suggestions of what you want to see on the Morelia Python store, let us know. We're probably going to add a few more T-shirt designs that we're working on right now. We're probably going to add a T-shirt for E.B. Morelia and for Rogue Reptile. So if you guys want to sport, our gear, that's cool too. And, just let us know what you want to see on a T-shirt or a hoodie or something like that. We are probably going to start doing designs that don't involve Morelia. I mean, I think we have a rough scale python shirt in the works. And then I just started working on a ring python shirt, which I think is pretty cool looking. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, yeah, I guess we'll have to do a blood python one at some point as well.
I suppose.
We'll have to put some – I'll leave Owen to come up with the saying on it because he's pretty witty. So
blood pythons. Well, here it is. That would be pretty much – there you go.
I take that back.
Yeah. God.
I don't know if I have anything else really. I guess that's it. Next week, it's just me and you.
Cool.
There's a lot of Morelia stuff that we have to catch up on. There's a lot of cool new boards that are out there, and we haven't talked carpet pythons in a while. So, next week will be about that. And, we'll have a little more time with Robin and being able to talk about promoting your reptile business, which I think is a discussion that really takes a little longer than 15 minutes. So that should be cool. So that's next week's show. And then after that, we have Ben from Australian Addictions coming on, and he's coming on to talk about genetics specifically.
Which are always good to know.
Yes. He's going to talk a little bit about the tiger carpet and the genetics behind it. There was a little bit of controversy maybe a couple months back. Maybe it's a month now. I don't know. I'm not sure. But we didn't really get to hit on it too much. But, we'll hit on it on the next show of our thoughts. But, anyway, he's coming on because Ben taught genetics. So he knows a thing or two about it. So
he's a doctor of breeding and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a reason he's called Dr. Ben, guys. So
yeah, pretty smart guy. And then the following week, we're getting a double dose of Australian Addiction. The following week, I'm not sure if everybody knows, but Justin, I guess it's been a little while since he's been on this trip, but he went on a trip to Australia, and he's going to a little bit of a different type of show, but he's going to be talking to us about his adventures, some of the things that he came across. I'm sure we'll have pictures of all the stuff that he saw. So we'll cover all different types of Australian reptiles in that episode. And, that's pretty much it for now.
Sweet.
So I'll just shoot down the list. And we forgot to give the shout-out at the beginning of the show for, Maria Python's Forum.
What do you call it? Did you really just say that?
Yeah, I did. What an ass.
Yeah. Well, whoops.
Yeah, so www.moreliapythons.com. It's probably the best forum, I think, around. I hope it'll pick back up and people will go there and that will be the place again. I have faith.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's that. moreliapythonsradio.com. You can check out the blog, the store, anything that we have going on. I posted up a couple new morphs of carpet pythons. So if you're new to if you're listening to this show and you're a blood python person and you're curious about carpet pythons, the best thing that you can do is head over to moreliapythonradio.com. You could click on the Morelia Complex and go down the list and see all the different species that are associated with the complex. And then you can continue on to the morphs of the Morelia Complex, and that'll give you an idea of all the different morphs and the combinations that are going on for carpet pythons. We broke them down by species, and then as you get close to the bottom, they're all kind of linked in there as the frankensnakes, which the blood python people do not do.
Nope.
That's a no-no. But, yeah, check it out. You can always download the show on iTunes. What else? If you have questions, comments, like Owen said, if you're looking for a specific topic, something you want us to talk about, remember the Reptile Insider as well. So if you want to talk about that, by all means, head on over and send us an email and let us know a topic that you'd like us to talk about. What else? I'll give a shout out to our good friends over at GTP Keeper Radio. They have a show lined up. I believe it's tomorrow, and they're talking to Greg Maxwell. They were able to bring him out of retirement and talk to him about chondros and that should be a really cool show. So they're over on Blog Talk as well, just like us. And we have links over on our page as well. But be sure to check that show out. That'll be a show that you won't want to miss. He's done some cool stuff when it comes to designer chondros. As far as myself, you can check out ebmorelia.com. If you have any questions, or maybe you want to get on a list for some stuff, you can contact me at eric@ebmorelia.com. Sign up for the newsletter as soon as I have babies available. We will be sending out the newsletter of what's available, shipping them out. I'm just going to start shipping snakes out to
you start shipping snakes to people. If you're lucky enough to get one, hold on to it.
And be sure to send me money for it.
Yeah, please. It's an honor system. I send you albino zebra tag. You send me $10,000.
I swear to God. I can't do two things at once. What the heck?
Yep. Clearly we've come off hinge here. So.
Yeah. And that's pretty much all I got. yeah, that's it for me. Go ahead, Owen.
Okay. What I'll say is you can go to rogue-reptiles.com, see all the latest animals that are for sale at Rogue and all our latest happenings as well as breeding news. Also, this Saturday we will be at the Hamburg Reptile Show in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. If you're in the area, please come out. It is a great show. I'll be there. I'll have a bunch of my animals with me. I know Jason Balin will also be there. I know Howard Redding of Redding Reptile Breeders will be there. And I know Mo of Mojo Reptiles might be there. I'm not sure. But
okay.
It's a good show. Come on out and hang out at the stable, talk carpet pythons. It's always good. Other than that, our ads are up on the Rogue Reptiles Facebook page as well as RogueReptiles.com. If you want to or see anything else, just let us know. I have to do this because I promised him I would because he bugged me. This is Buddy at Stony Creek Captives. It is his birthday, and we're going to wish him a happy birthday, Buddy. So,
oh, there you go. Happy birthday,
yeah,
Buddy.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Apparently he's missing his birthday dinner. I think he's kind of just milking it there because he wanted me to say this on the radio, but, you know. Kind of making me feel bad going,
now?
I'm missing my birthday. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Anyway, now that's over with. Just kidding. We love you, Buddy. What we can do, what I'll say now is thank you, everybody, for tuning in this week, and we hope to catch you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Hey, Chad Brown here. You may remember me as a linebacker in the NFL or as a reptile breeder and the owner of Pro Exotics. I've been herping since I was a boy, and I've dedicated my life to advancing the industry and educating the community about the importance of reptiles. I also love to encourage the joy of breeding and keeping reptiles as a hobbyist, which is why my partner Robin Markland and I created the Reptile Report. The Reptile Report is our online news aggregation site bringing you the most up-to-date discussions from the reptile world. Visit thereptilereport.com every day to stay on top of the latest reptile news and information. We encourage you to visit the site and submit your exciting reptile news, photos, and links so we can feature outstanding breeders and hobbyists just like you. The Reptile Report offers powerful branding and marketing exposure for your business, and the best part is, it's free. If you're a buyer or a breeder, you gotta check out the Reptile Report Marketplace. The Marketplace is the reptile world's most complete buying and selling destination, full of features to help put you in touch with the perfect deal. Find exactly what you're looking for with our advanced search system. Search by sex, weight, morph, or other keywords, and use our Buy It Now option to buy that animal right now. Go to marketplace.thereptilereport.com and register your account for free. Be sure to link your Marketplace account to your Ship Your Reptiles account to earn free tokens with each shipping label you book. Use the Marketplace to sell your animals and supplies and maximize your exposure with a platinum ad that also gets fed to the Reptile Report and our powerful Marketplace Facebook page. Buying or selling? Use shipyourreptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates. ShipYourReptiles.com can also supply you with the materials needed to safely ship your animals successfully. Use ShipYourReptiles.com to take advantage of our discounted priority overnight shipping rates, the materials needed to ship the reptiles successfully, live customer support, and our live, on-time arrival insurance program. We got you covered. Visit thereptilereport.com to learn or share about the animals. Click on the link to the marketplace, find that perfect pet or breeder, then visit shipreptiles.com to ship that animal anywhere in the United States. We are your one-stop shop for everything reptile related.